pop and not so pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Relief team. When we come to Relief team. When we come together, we become part of something bigger than us all. To find out how you can volunteer, visit redcross.org. The American Red Cross.
If George W. keeps telling us that global warming is not happening, and that even if it is, it's nothing to worry about, why are his Pentagon planners warning that, quote, there is substantial evidence that significant global warming will occur during the 21st century, that this will lead to, quote, an abrupt climate change, and that this change could, quote, destabilize the geopolitical environment leading to skirmishes, battles, and even war? Winter storms in the Northeast, an inland sea enveloping part of Northern California, extended drought in crucial agricultural areas, food shortages, lack of fresh water, and energy shortages. It notes that nations with food and water resources may build fortresses around them to stave off have-not nations clamoring for survival. This is Jim Hightower saying, the report does not say that all of this will happen, but that such a scenario is plausible, and that the risk of global warming, quote, should be elevated beyond a scientific debate to a U.S. national security concern. Now, someone read that to George W.
Federal college loan rates are currently lower than they have ever been, which means by refinancing now, you could cut your monthly student loan payment by up to 50%. By calling 1-800-2-COLLEGE, you'll quickly be connected to College Loan Corporation. We will answer your questions, help you lower your payments, and secure a rate as low as 2.63%. It's easy, it's free, and so far, over 300,000 people have called. 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can make.
It's a wild day here at the stock market. Let's talk to some traders. How are you doing?
I'm taking a shelling, but I'm still gelling.
Okay, and how about you?
I'm gelling and selling. Gelling and selling.
My trades are smelling.
Mine too, but who cares?
We're gelling.
Are you gelling yet? Dr. Scholl's massaging gel insoles are made from the softest gel ever created. If you and your feet don't feel outrageously comfortable, you get your money back, guaranteed. Are you gelling? Dr. Scholl's.
Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, happy Thursday. Greetings, patriots, friends, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman broadcasting live, coast to coast, border to border, streaming around the planet. Well, it's George and it's the George and Dick show going on in Washington, D.C. I don't know if they've finished yet or not. But it's, you know, it's, by the way, just to catch up on the day here in our second hour in our Everything You Know Is Wrong segment, we're going to be talking with David Callahan, who wrote The Cheating Culture. He says we're all cheating and getting away with it. We're going to ask him about those who, you know, like Ken Lay and Bush and Cheney and what happened with Martha Stewart and all that. Anyhow, I thought that would be an interesting thing. In the third hour, I want to get into this whole issue of should Cheney change his position on the war? Some interesting polls out, and some interesting situations. What's going on, and how are the Iraqis responding to this? The Iraqi, you know, in Iraq now, there's this new ABC, CNN poll, CNN Time Warner poll, with some just absolutely startling results. about what the Iraqis think about America. We have now a majority of Iraqis actually wanting us to leave as soon as possible and willing to deal with the potentially disastrous consequences of it. Just average people. And also we find now that Americans are split, about evenly split, on 46% on both sides, saying one side saying, stay the course, and the other side saying, literally, cut and run, let's get out. And just, leave them to their own devices, let them figure it out. And some very, very difficult stuff there. But anyhow, the 9/11 Commission is talking to Cheney and Bush, and we've got this secret clip here. It's fascinating of their testimony. It's not supposed to have been recorded, but here's a little bit. It opens with the credit of the people who put this thing together, and then you hear George Bush. At least.
RedefeatBush.com presents Redefeat Bush Theater.
You're watching live testimony by President Bush and Vice President Cheney before the 9/11 Commission on B-Scam.
Well, of course, you know how we met. Goodness knows the whole world knows the story of how we met. I asked Dick to find me somebody good to be my vice president, somebody I could trust and open up to and get close to, and he chose himself to do that.
Oh, you remember this actually happened. George Bush put Dick Cheney, at the suggestion of his father, in charge of the task force to find a running mate for him for the year 2000, and Dick Cheney ended up, after evaluating and interviewing dozens of people, maybe hundreds of people, ended up recommending himself.
Oh, Mr. President, you're being too kind. I'm sure it was you and you.
From finding out.
Sure, we were under from our friends in the oil industry to get that done, even if we had to use soldiers to do it, was, at that point, let's just say, very intense.
And so we delivered a clear threat of military action against the Taliban in, what was it, Junior, July of 2001?
July, that's right, yeah.
Or just about 5 weeks before they dispatched the terrorists to strike us.
And Dick wants you to know.
Right, yes. I want you to know that I'm really, really sorry about all that, and I promise I will never do it again.
And I said to myself, I think that is just about all we need to know about that. The American people accept your pop.
For the 9/11 Commission, you're watching B-Scam.
And then the credit.
That was RedefeatBush.com's Redefeat Bush Theater.
There you go. So the RedefeatBush.com, Redefeat Theater, they purport to have a secret clip from the testimony. This is the testimony. It's going to be really fascinating to find out if anybody actually smuggles anything out of that. If we find out anything from it at all. I'm really looking forward to it. 1-866-888-9884, a telephone number, by the way, if you'd like to be on the program. We have some of the questions that the families have proposed that Bush and Cheney be asked. And at the very top, of course, why are you and Cheney answering questions together, even though the 9/11 Commission asked you to appear separately, and why won't you allow your testimony to be recorded? As Reuters reports, Bush and Cheney agreed under pressure from victims' families and the Commission to answer its questions in the Oval Office of the White House today, but only on the condition that they appear together and in private. The White House has tried to keep the session as secret as possible. In an age when Bush's every public utterance is transcribed for posterity, no tape recording or transcription of the session will be permitted, according to Reuters. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Joyce in Eureka, California is on the line. Hey, Joyce, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. I love your show.
Thanks.
And I've got a quotation, and I was wondering whether or not you could identify the speaker.
We'll see.
Okay.
What is this,
okay.
Stump the chump here?
Right, okay. Once you've got Baghdad, it's
the chump here.
Right, okay. Once you've got Baghdad, it's not clear what carry forces engaged in this war inside Iraq would fit the definition of quagmire, and we absolutely have no desire to get bogged down in that fashion.
Okay, I would suggest that the writer or speaker of that was George Herbert Walker Bush, the first Bush, but I may well be wrong.
No, it was Dick Cheney.
Oh, really? May well be wrong.
No, it was Dick Cheney.
Oh, really? Okay, well...
In 1991, explaining the first Bush administration's decision to end the Gulf War after Iraq had been expelled from Kuwait.
Yeah, same thing. I mean, you know, he
but
was...
But they criticize Kerry, you know, for changing a position, you know, on right. He was talking out of the other side of his mouth then.
Well, see, this is one of the things that causes me to think that maybe Bob Woodward is actually telling the truth. When Woodward suggests that the drive to go, even in those environments, nobody points out that if we simply stopped the privatization of Iraqi industries, turning Iraqi industries over to American corporations,
right.
this aggressive privatization program, if we stopped that, and if we allowed the Iraqis themselves rather than us to decide who buys their oil. And we may not end up with their oil. We may have to start saying, hey, you know, if you've got an SUV, you can't have a $100,000 tax deduction anymore, and we'll see fewer SUVs on the road. But, you know, if we were to simply do those two things, it would be fairly easy for us to kind of back out and bring the other countries in. The main reason that so many other countries are hostile to going in right now is because, you know, France, Germany, and Russia all had contracts to buy Iraqi oil. And when we took over Iraq, we said, we are voiding those contracts. Those were made with a government that we don't consider exists any longer, and we're giving all this stuff to American companies.
Right. It's economic imperialism.
It is. It very much is, yeah. And it just is not being raised in the media. And see, that's the biggest obstacle to a solution.
It reminds me, do you remember Bunker Hunt? Remember one of the Hunt brothers?
Yeah, the one who cornered the silver market. Yeah,
right.
in the 70s.
You think that it's Texans trying to corner the oil market of the world?
Well, as I've said many times in this program, I think that they're operating from this assumption that which has been stated in the past. George Herbert Walker Bush said, you know, the American lifestyle is not negotiable, and that's kind of the starting point. That if we're going to be 5% of the world's population and consume 25% of the world's oil, and we hit peak oil in 1974, that's when half of the oil in the North American continent that we have control of was pumped out. And our wells from Pennsylvania through the Midwest were dry. Texas was starting to dry up. California was starting to dry up.
Yeah, we stripped them all. Yeah.
Right. We starting in 1867 when Colonel Drake drilled the first well in Titusville, Pennsylvania. And you know, real aggressively in the late 18th and early 19th century with the rise of Standard Oil. Anyhow, if we're going to continue to be an oil-dependent economy, then we have to nail down the world's oil supplies. And that, you know, that is a rational argument,
right,
if you assume the premise of the argument, which is that that's the only way that we can be successful. And Jimmy Carter is the only president in the last 50 years who has rejected that premise, who has said, and Carter, interestingly, was a nuclear engineer.
Right.
I mean,
right.
You know, he's got a Ph.D. in nuclear engineering. He was a nuclear engineer on a submarine in the Navy.
Right.
The guy is no dummy. He understands how energy works. And he said, let's make America energy independent so that we don't have to be running all around the world protecting our oil supplies in unstable parts of the planet. And of course, Ronald Reagan came in with oil company money. And the first thing he did, his first official act of office, was to take Jimmy Carter's solar collectors off the top of the White House. And we've been going down this road ever since. And it's nuts.
Right,
anyhow,
absolutely.
Joyce, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Great to hear from you. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 20 minutes past the hour. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
Do you want to find out what the invasion of Iraq was really about? Read the new illustrated book, We the People, A Call to Take Back America by Tom Hartman. Once you've read We the People, you'll understand why conservatives are trying to bankrupt government and how perpetual war is used as a political strategy in the United States. You'll learn how our votes are in danger and what we must do about it. You'll discover why the Alien and Sedition Acts of 1798 matter today. Populist watchdog and national radio commentator Jim Hightower had this to say about We the People.
Not only does this book tell you what's really going on, but it even draws you a picture of it. Read, learn, and act.
We the People, A Call to Take Back America by Tom Hartman. A compelling story of how a government by and for the people has been replaced by corporate domination. Fully illustrated by Neil Cohn, We the People issues a call to action in a most entertaining way. Available in bookstores everywhere. A must-read, The Edison Gene, ADHD and the Gift of the Hunter Child by Tom Hartman, best-selling author of Attention Deficit Disorder, A Different Perception. Ed Halliwell, a nationally recognized expert on ADD, said this about The Edison Gene.
Tom Hartman demonstrates that ADHD can be associated with creativity, high achievement, and a most successful adaptive style.
The Edison Gene, now available in bookstores everywhere.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Credit card delinquency hit an all-time high at the end of 2003, according to the American Bankers Association. Nearly 4.5% of all U.S. credit card bills are a month or more past due. The ABA blames the situation squarely on the jobless recovery. Many Americans use their credit cards as stopgaps during times when money is tight. Couple that with the scarce job market and a rising rate of long-term unemployment, and conditions are ripe for rising delinquency.
Hey, how you doing? Got a quick question.
Yeah?
Who was Rudolf Nureyev?
Rudy Nureyev.
Rudy.
Okay, I know this one.
Good.
Wasn't he wasn't he a defenseman for the Maple Leafs? Sure about that? Could have been a goalie.
Yeah. Hey, how you doing? Who was Louis Armstrong?
That's easy. He was the first guy on the moon.
Really?
You know, one small step for man.
Sure, one giant leap for Louis. Hey, young lady.
Uh-huh.
Does the name Caravaggio mean anything to you?
Wasn't he the guy that went out with that mob guy's sister until he got whacked?
You know, no.
Are your kids as well-rounded as they could be? Kids who participate in the arts do better in school and in life. To learn more about the value of arts education, visit AmericansForTheArts.org. Because all kids should get to appreciate Nureyev's dance, Armstrong's horn, and Caravaggio's brush. Art. Ask for more. A public service message brought to you by Americans for the Arts and the Ad Council.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Agadol Ahmed Chalabi. Oh, Ahmed.
Remember back in a month, they found the money was gone. So you fled from the country as fast as you could, and you found yourself valuable friends. Richard Earl and Paul Wolfowitz knew you were ready to squeal. So you made up a whale of a deal for a hell of a deal.
Chalabi, yes. I don't know if you could hear the words there. It's about, you know, Ahmed Chalabi, the or Chalabi, depending on how you say it, the convicted bank swindler, sentenced to 22 years of hard labor in Jordan for the Petra Bank, which he started, he owned, he looted for $600 million. He left town as the Jordanians were investigating it, went to London, ended up in the United States, in bed with, metaphorically, politically, with Wolfowitz and Pearl. And used that money from the Petra Bank to create the Iraqi National Congress, which then fed all of the intelligence about how we would be greeted as liberators, not occupiers. And Saddam has weapons of mass destruction. Yes, indeed, he's got terrible things there. Fed that information to our administration that bought it hook, line, and sinker. Even though the CIA was saying, oh, wait a minute, or many within the CIA, apparently, if Woodward is to believe, not Mr. Tennant. Why does that man still have his job? I don't know. Anyway, one of the things I wanted to explore in this hour, and I want to get into this. And Saddam has weapons of mass destruction. Yes, indeed, he's got terrible things there. Fed that information to our administration that bought it hook, line, and sinker. Even though the CIA was saying, oh, wait a minute, or many within the CIA, apparently, if Woodward is to believe, not Mr. Tennant. Why does that man still have his job? I don't know. Anyway, one of the things I wanted to explore in this hour, and I want to get into the one of the things that I think most people don't understand. I want to give you a little ammunition for the water cooler wars here. And this is big picture stuff. We'll have, you know, plenty of time here in the 3 hours of the show to get into the details of, you know, what's going on in the day and get back into the nitty-gritty kind of micro. But the macro, you know, it's stepping back and looking at the big picture. What really is the difference? What are the roots of the conservative movement in the United States and the liberal movement in the United States? Well, authoritarian father figure, as it were, that can restrain people from acting out their inherent evilness. They're big believers in the idea of original sin. The idea that, the Greeks came up with it first, with the idea that Pandora had this box and she was curious and she opened it, and that caused all the problems of humanity, and therefore women should be oppressed. And then, of course, it made its way into the Bible with the story of Adam and Eve and so on. And in fact, you find this in the Epic of Gilgamesh, which is written 3,000 years before the Bible. So this is a story that's been around for a long time, that women are to blame for everything and therefore should be oppressed, and that because of the action of some early woman, the nature of human beings is essentially evil. That is the starting point for conservative thought going back to the 15th century, but particularly in the 1700s, with Edmund Burke and Thomas Hobbes and some of the other conservative thinkers who were the foundational thinkers of this. Liberals have a different view of human nature. I'll share that with you right after this break. There is, however, just a very different starting point from in the liberal worldview. And by liberal worldview, I'm talking about the worldview that was held by George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, James Monroe, George Mason, John Jay, and many of the other founders. Get into that right after this. It's 29 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you.
For 35 years, John Kerry's fought for his country.
We need to get some things done in this country. Affordable health care, rolling back tax cuts for the wealthy, really investing in our kids. That's why I'm running for president.
John Kerry, the military experience to defend America. A new plan to create jobs and put our economy back on track.
I'm John Kerry, and I approve this message because it's time to put opportunity in the hands of all Americans.
John Kerry, a new direction for
pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
This is WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
It'll soon be easier to follow the flow of U.S. jobs overseas due to the latest initiative by the Washington Alliance of Technology Workers and the Communication Workers of America. The groups are launching a website called Offshore Tracker that will include the total number of jobs sent offshore by date and details about companies exporting the jobs. CWA and WashTech expect they'll only be counting about 20% of jobs lost because many companies force their employees to sign non-disclosure agreements. The website is www.texunite.org/offshore.
In what's believed to be the largest public settlement ever for a case involving HIV-related discrimination, a former performer with Cirque du Soleil will receive $600,000 from the avant-garde acrobatic troupe. Matthew Cusick was fired from the troupe's resident show in Las Vegas last July after his HIV-positive status was revealed, even though company physicians cleared him for performance. Claims that Cusick was a safety hazard provided the justification. But following an investigation by the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, which concluded Cirque du Soleil had discriminated by firing Cusick, the company agreed to the settlement yesterday.
After a year-long strike against meat processing giant Tyson Foods, the membership of the United Food and Commercial Workers Wisconsin Local 538 elected a new president. Of the 329 striking union workers who have asked to come back to work at the Jefferson, Wisconsin plant, 120 are still waiting to return. The new president will have to deal with this, ongoing contract talks with Oscar Mayer, and negotiations with Jones Dairy expected to begin this summer.
Only essential and emergency health services are available in British Columbia this week as 43,000 hospital and clinic workers with Canada's Hospital Employees Union strike to stop a government campaign to privatize the province's health care. Since the government opened up the sector to contracting out 2 years ago, one out of every eight health care workers in the province have either been laid off or seen their wages dramatically reduced. The walkout began on Sunday, but yesterday the BC government took the steps toward ordering the strike to be stopped, which could result in the issuance of a back-to-work order by as early as tomorrow.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. According to the Labor Research Association, President Bush, unlike the 8.4 million unemployed workers in the United States, has more money than he can spend. Bush has raised so much money that he's suspended all further fundraising for his 2004 presidential campaign. Bush now has the largest campaign fund of any candidate in U.S. history, $180 million. His Democratic challenger, John Kerry's war chest, is $100 million short of that amount.
You've been listening to WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. 26 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Okay, here it is. On the one side, the conservative side was really framed way back when, back in the 1700s, by Thomas Hobbes. You'll recall Thomas Hobbes was the man who wrote that the life of people before civilization was short, brutish, and nasty. And it turns out that, you know, our contact with tribal people who are still living the way that people lived before what we call civilization indicates that many of them, some of them actually have short, brutish, and nasty lives, but many, if not most of them, have pretty decent lives. The original leisure society, typically hunting-gathering societies, spend about 2 hours a day doing all their work and spend the rest of the time playing, hanging out with family, those kinds of things. Yes, it's hard to imagine, but there's good anthropology to back it up, a lot of it. But anyhow, Thomas Hobbes had this strong idea that people are essentially evil in their nature and therefore must be controlled, and that the agent of control should be government. On the other hand, at the same time that Hobbes was talking about this, or relatively the same time, John Locke came along. And John Locke, in his second treatise on government, is probably his most famous piece, which I believe was published in 1724. John Locke suggested that the true nature of people is actually good. You do have some people who are evil. You do have some people who are twisted, who are damaged beyond repair. And the job of society is to isolate itself from them or isolate them from society. And so therefore you have prisons or in tribal communities. And you find this the stories of this in the Bible. They used to have these what they call communities of refuge where they would just incorrigible people that they couldn't do anything else with. There's nothing they could do. They weren't willing to kill the guy. And so they send them off to this place. They banish them, banish them to the island sort of thing. I mean, this is something that goes back in human history. Probably a million years. I mean, who knows? But it goes way, way back. But Locke's idea was that people, the vast majority of people, are actually good. That's the substrate. That's the norm. That's the core idea of human nature. And because people are fundamentally good, you can trust the majority of people to make the most appropriate decision, even in a situation of virtually absolute freedom to make the most appropriate situation in a way that's going to be best for all of society, for everybody involved, not just themselves. And, of course, this was revolutionary. I mean, nobody had suggested anything like what John Locke was suggesting. Well, Rousseau had, you know, before Locke. But then there had been these, you know, little blips here and there. Even Da Vinci talked about something like this a little bit. But by and large, this was considered a radical idea. Because for thousands of years, ever since Gilgamesh, 7,000 years ago, there had been this idea that you had to have kings, you had to have feudal lords, or you had to have popes or mullahs to have an absolute tight grip on people and on their behavior. Because if you didn't, terrible things would happen, because the normal nature of people is evil. And you see this played out in this dichotomy, this difference, this opposite worldview in many different ways. For example, in Iraq right now, there are many people who are saying, well, you know, if we were to pull out, people being evil as they are, evil would triumph in Iraq and you'd end up with evil people taking over and it would be a terrible mess. And then you've got people saying, you know, both in the United States and in Iraq, and of course all around the world, if we were to pull out right now, there might be some bad stuff going on, and the majority of Iraqis are good people and they will figure this out. They will ultimately figure it out. They will work out something. They understand what democracy is. They understand how it works. They've never had one. But they're not stupid. And they have an opportunity. It may not be what we, you know, what we would call a democracy. For example, they may not have a separation of church and state. Well, I mean, you know, we're not the only democracy. I'm sorry. There are other democracies, other, quote, liberal democracies that don't have a separation of church and state. For example, England, the United Kingdom, has an official church, the Church of England. The Queen is the head of the Church of England. She appoints the Archbishop of Canterbury, Archduke of Canterbury, whatever it is, and, you know, the head of the church. But she's ultimately the head of the church, so, you know, you have an official state religion there in the United Kingdom. So, you know, maybe the Iraqis will say, well, you know, we're gonna do this thing and we're going to do a democracy. We'll have a parliament and we'll let people get elected. But we're going to also have an official state religion. It's going to be Islam. That's a possibility. So also you see this played out. This again, the worldview, the difference in these two worldviews played out. The Lockean liberal, people can work things out. Let's trust them to make the right decisions. Versus the Hobbesian, people are evil. If you trust them to make decisions, they will always get it wrong, and they will always create disaster. We also see this played out in Iraq again, in the argument, and this goes back to before the war, before George Bush decided optionally to invade the country before the weapons inspectors had finished their inspections. It goes back to the idea of, is it best to conduct ourselves around the world to accomplish the goals of the United States, however you define those, whether you want to define them as in the negative context of economic imperialism, or you want to define them in the positive context of being a beacon of liberty around the planet, however you want to define them? And of course, the reality is that it's all of the above and a lot of stuff in the middle. Is the best way to conduct our affairs, is the best way to conduct the process of accomplishing what we want to accomplish around the world, by going in with an iron fist? That would be Hobbes's choice. That would be Russell Kirk's choice. That would be the historic conservative worldview choice. Because people are evil and they only respond to the iron fist. Or do you go in with diplomacy and try and work things out? Try and, you know, trust people to ultimately want to operate in their own self-interest and in the best interest of society as well. That people actually understand that they have to have a society around them that's functional, or they themselves are not going to be functional and happy. And do you rely on diplomacy? And this was the big argument. And the neocon worldview that prevailed within this administration and was so different from the worldview of the former Bush administration, oddly enough. I mean, you could say by these definitions, to some extent, George Herbert Walker Bush was a liberal in as much as he was coming out of a worldview that said people are essentially good, and with diplomacy you can work things out with them, with pretty much anybody. Now, you know, of course there were some bad people he tried to work things out with. The Bush-Reagan administration left us the legacy of Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein, not to mention other dictators around the world. We created Osama bin Laden in order to support the insurgency in Afghanistan against Russia, to irritate the Russians and to try and seize Afghanistan because it was strategically significant for that oil pipeline, or actually it's a natural gas pipeline, across the country from the Caspian Sea down to the Arabian Sea so that we could get the natural resources out of there. And we funded him and we trained him. And you know, Saddam Hussein, Don Rumsfeld went over and cut deals with him, supplied him with weapons of mass destruction, supplied him with the gas to gas the Kurds and to gas the, you know, 1 million Iranians during that war. Now Iran is, you know, you've got Iranian families who died in of their kids died as soldiers in that war, suing the United States for $600 million for reparations because we supplied Saddam with those weapons. But in any case, you could say that because the Brent Scowcrofts and the George Herbert Walker Bushes and the Colin Powells of that early administration were saying, we can work this out diplomatically. We don't have to use the iron fist. That they were more in line with the traditional liberal ideology than the traditional conservative ideology. Some of the myths about conservatives. One of the myths about conservatives is that they want less government. They like to say this. But if you look at the facts, you find, for example, just in recent history, that the two largest expansions of government since the 1950s occurred under the presidencies of Ronald Reagan and George Walker Bush, George W. Bush. And the most significant reduction in the size of government occurred under the administration of Bill Clinton, and the second most significant reduction occurred under Jimmy Carter, or a slowing of growth, actually, in the case of Carter. There was an actual reduction under Clinton. So, you know, what they're really saying is that one of the most common themes of the conservatives is that there's a concentration of power is a good thing, but we don't trust the masses. It goes back to the idea of the divine right of kings. You know, they opposed the Protestant Reformation. It took power from Rome. This conservatives way back. You know, honestly, try to come up with one example of conservatives who want to relinquish more power to the masses. You won't find one. It's just, you know, it's not there. John Adams, the first really and truly conservative president of the United States, referred to the average person as the rabble. And he was very wary of the rabble. Jefferson, on the other hand, the first liberal president of the United States, said, throw open the doors. You know, when the British ambassador to the United States first showed up, Jefferson answered the door in a house coat and slippers as a way of saying, I'm not going to have anything to do with all this pomp and ceremony. He started shaking hands with people. Adams, you know, bowed. Adams was trying to recreate the court of Versailles in some ways. You know, the European splendor of the presidency, and Jefferson would have nothing to do with it. A few days every week, Jefferson actually, you know, the front door of the White House was open. Anybody could walk in and talk to him. Adams would have nothing to do with that. Absolute barriers there. So with the history of the United States, by and large, has been a history of moving more and more toward, up until the last 20 years, moving more and more toward liberal ideals. The other burp was in the Gilded Age, but the progressive and populist movement came out of that. Government's becoming more democratic and more liberal, taking power away from the elites. And the new form of concentrated power is private corporations, not democratic governments. This is where it's happening. And conservatives want to keep the filthy masses out of the business of the corporate elite. And that's what they mean by reducing government. Conservatives still believe in strong police states and militaries to protect their property. Now, this goes back to the whole right of property. John Locke, actually, the liberal, was the guy in 1724 who originated the phrase life, liberty, and property, the right of property. And it's been attached to classic liberalism, but Locke was referring to property being taken by the king and his monopolies. He wasn't defending the right of an aristocracy
to hold property, and at the expense of the masses. Conservatives have perverted this to make the right of property paramount over all other rights, even the right of life itself. You know, you can shoot somebody for trespassing on your property, say diehard conservatives. Liberals have concentrated more on the rights of life and liberty, specifically human rights, as being more important than property rights. Another, you know, here's another schism, another divide. This shift is evident in Thomas Jefferson's revision of Locke. When Jefferson was writing the Declaration of Independence, he didn't say, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed with their creator and certain inalienable rights, that these include life, liberty, and the right to property. No, he didn't say that. He changed Locke. This was the first step in the evolution of modern democracies. I mean, this was the first democracy to come along in over 2,000 years. And he said, no, the right of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, the first time happiness as a word had ever appeared in any foundational document for any government, anywhere ever. And so we see, you know, Edmund Burke, you know, father of modern conservatism. He was born in 1729, died in 1797. After the American Revolution, he was British. And he said, a well-governed society is one where people know their place. Here's another quote from him. The rich, the able, and the well-born should govern, while the people of lower social rank should recognize their betters. He said the elite should rule, but it should rule with responsibility. This idea of the noblesse oblige, that if you are part of the nobility, you have an obligation to be ethical. He wrote, the occupation of a hairdresser or of a working tallow chandler, candlemaker, cannot be a matter of honor to any person, to say nothing of a number of more servile employments, such as being a maid or something. Such description of men ought not to suffer oppression from the state, but the state suffers oppression if such as they, either individually or collectively, are permitted to rule. This Edmund Burke, the founder of conservative thought, and his thinking is still echoed today. I mean, you find William F. Buckley quoting Burke, you find Russell Kirk quoting Burke, you find Barry Goldwater quoting Kirk. Burke, rather. So this was that core notion. And, you know, and later on in another program, I don't want to get too deeply into this because, you know, you can start to drown in this stuff. But I want to get into the economic policies also. What is the difference between David Ricardo and Thomas Malthus? And we'll do it in a way that doesn't sound like a college course, I promise you. It's 11 minutes before the hour. We've got about a minute, and Chris in New Mexico is on the line. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Not much, Tom. Tomorrow night, ABC's Nightline is apparently going to be doing a half-hour-long homage to the war dead, wherein Ted Koppel is going to read one after another the names of the American servicemen.
Yeah, somebody called in yesterday and told us about that.
Good. And the right wing is up in arms about this. This is apparently a totally politically driven show, and my God, into it.
Amazing. Thanks, Chris. Yeah, thanks. Can you imagine honoring our war dead is political? Makes no sense to me. 10 minutes before the hour, it's Tom Hartman here with you.
Are you frustrated by your constant inability to lose weight? Are you looking for a natural, clinically proven weight loss breakthrough? Introducing CarboBlocker. Unlike anything else on the market, CarboBlocker is backed by clinical research that proves it effectively helps block the fattening effects of carbs without stimulants. Your body will think you're eating a low-carb diet even when you're not. The results are simply amazing. If you want to maintain the weight loss effects of low-carb dieting for the long run, if you're tired of clothes that are too tight and you want to look fit and sexy, then CarboBlocker is for you. It's clinically effective. Formula is safe, natural, and stimulant-free. And as a special introductory offer, when you order 2 bottles of Carbo Blocker, you'll get 2 bottles of Appetite Blocker absolutely free. Call in the next 10 minutes, and you'll also receive 2 free books, Lose Fat Now and the Low Carb Cookbook, a $100 value. Absolutely free, so call now, 1-800-743-5704. Guaranteed to work or your money back, so call now, 1-800-743-5704. That's 1-800-743-5704.
While the world seems to be collapsing around us, there is hope. Tom Hartman's inspiring book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, The Fate of the World and What We Can Do Before It's Too Late, has just been re-released.
The new updated version is available now and offers solutions to the issues that concern us most: eco-damage, genetic engineering, virulent disease, the end of cheap oil, water shortages, global famine, wars. We can still do something about it and create a world that will work for us and our children's children. As the inspiration for Leonardo DiCaprio's web movie Global Warning, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight details what is happening to our planet, the reason for our culture's blind behavior, and how we can fix the problem. There is information. There is hope. The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, The Fate of the World and What We Can Do Before It's Too Late. Now with new updated information, available in bookstores everywhere.
Are you or a loved one making too many trips to the bathroom? Listen closely, because you're not alone. Over 30 million men suffer from an enlarged prostate. That's why if you make frequent trips to the bathroom, have urgency, hesitancy, or a diminished sex drive, then Super Prostate Formula is for you. It was designed by nationally recognized physician Dr. Michael Toplitsky. Results with his patients have been amazing. Reclaim control now and join the thousands of satisfied customers who have had incredible results with Super Prostate Formula. When you order two bottles of Dr. Toplitsky's Super Prostate Formula, you'll also get two bottles of his Super Libido Formula, an all-natural alternative to Viagra to enhance sexual vitality and performance, plus his book, Complete Guide to Prostate Health, and his newsletter, a total $100 value free as your gift. Guaranteed, or your money back. If you're not completely satisfied, return it for a full refund and keep his Libido Formula book and newsletter free as your gift. Not available in stores. Call now, 800-452-0978. 800-452-0978. That's 800-452-0978.
Pavement and pumps are hard on underground supplies of fresh water. I'm Richard Hoops for Earthwatch Radio. The water that sits in underground aquifers might be out of sight, but it is very much a part of everyday life. It's the fundamental source of water for many streams and wetlands, and it's an essential source of drinking water for many people. But these aquifers need to be recharged with water from the surface, and that doesn't happen easily when the landscape is covered with roads and parking lots. Gene Barr says the water tables in aquifers will drop if we take water out and don't let it seep back in. Barr is a hydrogeology professor at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, and she's an expert on groundwater and the way we affect it.
When you pave over the landscape with roads and with houses and parking lots, then the water that falls on the landscape doesn't have a chance to infiltrate, and it usually gets collected in storm drains that drain the streets. The storm drains then empty often into detention ponds, but essentially we're short-circuiting the groundwater system.
Barr says there are ways to get more water to percolate through the soil and recharge the underground aquifers. One is a simple backyard device that captures water off roofs and other hard surfaces.
For example, localized infiltration structures called rain gardens that people can put in their backyards capture the water that falls on their roof or on their driveway and allows that water to percolate through a very permeable zone in the subsurface and down to the groundwater table.
A lot of people are promoting rain gardens as a way to handle stormwater in a more natural manner and to replenish groundwater reserves at the same time. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Sea Grant Program and the Gaylord Nelson Institute at the University of Wisconsin.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It was late in December, the sky turned to snow. All around the day was going down slow. Night like a river beginning to flow. I felt the beat of my mind go drifting into time passages.
And welcome back. 4 minutes before the hour, it's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Unanswered questions. Bush and Cheney facing serious questions today about how their post-9/11 assertions compare to pre-9/11 reality. Notes David Sirota of the Center for American Progress. For instance, why did the president repeatedly say the government had no knowledge that terrorists had designs on using airplanes as weapons when that is clearly not the case?
Why, when the president was receiving repeated warnings about an increased terrorist threat in the summer of 2001, did he not issue one public warning and instead continued on the longest vacation in presidential history? And why, after the worst national security breakdown in history, could the president not admit his administration had made even one mistake since taking office? You recall, I believe it was in Davos, when the G8, G9 summit, and the word came down that Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, were intending to hijack planes and fly them into the facility. And the United States government participated in putting up an air defense perimeter. And George Bush slept on a yacht off the coast in a clandestine. Everybody thought he was there on the ground in one of the hotels. He was actually sleeping in a yacht, as were some members of the British delegation. You know, completely separate. And because they had gotten this warning. This was years ago. I mean, this was before 9/11. Because they had gotten this warning, or it was in the months before 9/11, because they had gotten this warning that Al-Qaeda was going to fly this plane into it. It's unanswered questions. Bush and Cheney also faced questions about their well-documented decisions before 9/11. For example, why did they allow Attorney General John Ashcroft to de-emphasize and cut funding for terrorism or counterterrorism at the same time that threat warnings were spiking? If terrorism was a top priority before 9/11, as the Bush administration claims, why did Bush, Cheney, and National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice never once mention bin Laden or Al-Qaeda before 9/11? Never once. Why did the Bush administration say the Clinton administration's focus on bin Laden before 9/11 was, to use their language, a mistake? Why? These are some of the unanswered questions. Bush and Cheney have never offered an explanation about why, in February 2001, they rejected security recommendations from the U.S. government's Bipartisan Commission on National Security, the Warren Rudman and Gary Hart Commission, who said, hey, we're going to be hit, guys. And they said, I don't think so. Good questions. We'll see if any answers come out of it. It'll be interesting to see the final report of this commission. This is the Tom Hartman Radio Program, Uncommon Sense from the Radical Middle.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
Did you know that grapes are one of the most heavily sprayed of all agricultural products? Most people don't. But that is why it's so very important to drink wines that are made with certified organic grapes. And that is exactly what we are inviting you to do today. Taste our wines. We select them personally. They come from small properties in the south of France. They are delicious. Connoisseurs love them. And they are earth-friendly. My name is Véronique. I founded the Organic Wine Company in 1980 for people just like you. People who love wine and want to do well by our earth. Call us at 1-888-ECO-WINE. We'll answer all your questions. I look forward to talking with you. Call 1-888-ECO-WINE. And that is ECOWINE.
Pop and not so pop culture, democracy and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
News break from the Minuteman News Service.
This is Don Waller in New York. 9 U.S. soldiers were killed in attacks around Baghdad Thursday, 8 of them when a car bomb exploded just south of the capital. The car bomb went off just south of Baghdad near Mahmoudia around 11:30 a.m. local time, the U.S. military said in a statement. Initial reports indicate that 8 U.S. soldiers were killed and 4 were wounded. The soldiers were all from the 1st Armored Division and the wounded were flown to Baghdad Military Hospital by helicopter. In a separate incident, a U.S. soldier was killed in a rocket-propelled grenade attack in eastern Baghdad, bringing April's death toll to 125. George W. Bush's approval rating is at an all-time low, and fewer than half of Americans now believe invading Iraq was the right thing to do, according to a CBS New York Times poll released on Wednesday. The poll found that if the presidential election due in November was held today, 46% of Americans would vote for Democrat John Kerry and 44% would vote for Bush if independent Ralph Nader stayed out of the race. Just 32%, the lowest number ever, say Iraq was a threat that required immediate military action 1 year ago, the poll reported. Most Iraqis believe the ouster of Saddam Hussein was worth the hardships they have endured since the U.S.-led invasion, but Iraqis are sharply divided over whether the country is better off, according to a CNN USA Today Gallup poll released Wednesday. 42% of Iraqis say they believe their country is better off since the invasion launched more than a year ago, while 46% said the war has done more harm than good. Among the findings, the poll said that Iraqi attitudes towards foreign troops have hardened considerably. When asked how they now view coalition forces, 71% of all Iraqis said mostly as occupiers, while 19% said mostly as liberators, the poll said. More Minuteman News after this.
Hi, I'm Jim, and this is my calendar. And I'm setting aside Monday for something special.
And I'm Tina. I'll see your Monday and raise you a Tuesday afternoon.
Oh, yeah? Well, I'm Miguel, and I'm giving up a whole week.
When a lot of people give even a little time to the Red Cross, it adds up to quite a lot. A blood drive, a first aid class, a disaster relief team. When we come together, we become part of something bigger than us all. To find out how you can volunteer, visit redcross.org. The American Red Cross. Together we can save a life.
They say twins feel each other's pain, but 8-year-olds Cassidy and Marissa Weiss of Laurel, Nebraska may have taken that idea a bit too far. In a 5-hour span on April 17th, both girls had rolling skating accidents that resulted in broken left arms. Cassidy broke her arm while skating at a friend's birthday party. Later that evening, Marissa was demonstrating her skating skill to her mother, Tammy, when she fell and broke her arm. The twins were outfitted in matching blue casks. Cassidy was to wear her cast for about 3 weeks. Because Marissa's break was more severe, she was to wear hers for 6. For the Minuteman News Service, this is Don Waller in New York.
Minuteman News Break is a production of TakeBackTheMedia.com.
Step right up, seniors, for it's time to play Medicare Gotcha. As you know, the drug companies have been ripping off us consumers, charging exorbitant prices in the U.S. for medicines they sell elsewhere for half or even a third as much. Because of public outrage over this gouging, Bush and his Congress had to look like they were doing something. So last year they rammed into law the Medicare Drug Discount Program for senior citizens. The program, which begins in June, is a bedazzling, convoluted, privatized shell game rigged with enough trickery to make a county fair flim-flammer blush. Start with the fact that rather than simply stopping the price gouging, as other countries have done, Bush's program subsidizes it, putting some $139 billion of our tax money into the pockets of the drug giants. Then there's the corporate hucksterism built into the new system. If you think phone company come-ons are confusing, wait till you try to compare the dizzying array of private drug discount plans that'll fill your mailbox. Pharmacy chains, drug companies, insurance peddlers, online firms, and others will try to lure you into taking their card. They'll all offer different enrollment fees, different discounts on their list of drugs, and different lists of drugs that they cover. Not only will each company have its own price list, but grab your wallet, their prices can change weekly. Yes, this means that a company can hook you into taking its card by offering low prices on the medicines you use most often, then, gotcha, jack up its prices the next week. Well, you say, if they do that, I'll just switch companies. Gotcha again. Bush's law only lets you switch cards once a year. This is Jim Hightower saying, getting the medicines you need ought not to be a game, much less a game rigged to enrich drug industry ripoff artists. It's time for a national health plan in America, based on people's needs, not on drug company profits.
Sometimes it takes an army to help one child. It's the Salvation Army, and it needs your help to send needy children to camp this summer. To donate, call 1-800-SALARMY or donate online at 1-800-SALARMY.org. This Army can't help a single child without you.
It's a wild day here at the stock market. Let's talk to some traders. How are you doing?
I'm taking a shelling, but I'm still gelling.
Okay, and how about you?
I'm gelling and selling. Gelling and selling.
My trades are smelling.
Mine too, but who cares?
We're gelling.
Are you gelling yet? Dr. Scholl's massaging gel insoles are made from the softest gel ever created. If you and your feet don't feel outrageously comfortable, you get your money back, guaranteed. Are you gelling? Dr. Scholl's.
He's the man who uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 7 minutes past the hour. It's Tom Hartman broadcasting live coast to coast, border to border on terrestrial stations from California to North Carolina, streaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, beaming around the planet on radiopower.org. It's the second hour of our Thursday afternoon program. Time for us to stretch our minds a bit, just step out of the normal kind of political rant. And get into something that maybe you didn't even know that you didn't know. It's our everything you know wrong segment.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync. You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Maybe. Everything you know about human nature could be. I don't know. We'll find out. David Callen is co-founder and director of research at the Public Policy Center, Demos. The author of 5 books. He has published articles in the New York Times, The Washington Post, USA Today, and has been a frequent commentator on CNN, MSNBC, and NPR. He received his PhD in politics from Princeton University and lives in New York City. David, welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
Thank you. Here's the setup. And it's a great setup from the dust jacket of your book. Your next door neighbor offers to hook you up free with cable television. Or when you unexpectedly owe hundreds of dollars in taxes, your accountant says to just make up some deductions since the IRS doesn't audit anyone. Do you do it? What do you think? What choice do most Americans make?
Well, it depends. I mean, there are many Americans out there who do cheat on their taxes, who do, get free cable television. And the way many of these people justify this is they point to how they're being ripped off by the system. You know, so they say, hey, that cable television company, you know, it charges outrageous rates. Why not get free HBO if I get a chance? Or
TV provider. In fact, it's my cable TV provider here at Adelphia. And, people sit around going, hey, if they're going to steal from Adelphia, why shouldn't I?
Exactly. And that's a common kind of logic. You know, I look at increased cheating across American society from the people at the top, you know, the CEOs who've been ripping off people, all the way down to those at the bottom, you know, who engage in a lot of this sort of nickel and dime stuff. And I make a connection between the two and say, you know, many Americans, they're looking at the corporate scandals. They look at how rich people can take advantage of tax shelters and scams. You know,
David?
Please enter the phone number you wish to reach.
We have lost David. We'll get him back on in just a second. It seems like it's not our week for telephony. Must be Mr. Ashcroft here visiting us. Who knows? Anyhow, did you know that the Center for American Progress has got this really cool new database? They just launched this a couple days ago. I wanted to tell you about it. It's the Claims versus Fact database, stories of what's going on with the administration. It's www.claimvfact.org. And I was playing with this thing last night. It is just great. You can find a topic, and you can find somebody in the administration who has talked about that topic, by and large the administration, and you get the claims versus facts. And I think David is back on the line. Is that David, you're back on the line?
Yeah, I'm here.
Hey, I'm sorry about that. Suddenly we had an operator talking to us. Please dial the number you want. Anyhow, as you were saying, people are increasingly cheating. Finish your thought, if you don't mind.
Well, my thought is that, you know, I look at people cheating at the top, what I call the winning class, the corporate CEOs, the big shots who have all too often been caught up in these scandals and crime in the executive suite. And I make the argument that a lot of those people are cheating because they can, because they think that they can get away with it, and all too often that's the case.
Right.
Meanwhile, a lot of ordinary people, people who are part of the anxious class, they're often cheating because they think, hey, the system's stacked against the little guy. I want to get, you know, I want to beat the system. And they're often feeling a fair amount of financial insecurity. You know, a lot of anxiety out there about making ends meet in America these days. And so, you know, you stir that all together and you get a lot of cynicism, a lot of dishonesty.
Do you think that the economic policies that really started under Reagan when he started deconstructing unions, starting with PATCO, and encouraging with winks and nods and pulling back on the National Labor Relations Board. Now we've got Elaine Chao, you know, the Secretary of Labor, who's actually anti-labor. That this whole conservative movement that started in 1980 to disempower workers and place proportionally more power in the hands of owners and bosses, which has led to the evisceration, the hollowing out of the middle class of America. I mean, it's just basically not possible anymore, like it was when I grew up in the 50s and 60s, for a single wage earner, just, you know, with a high school diploma, to support a family, put their kids through college, and pay for their own health care and have a pension when they retire. It's just not possible anymore. Do you think that that has something to do with why more people are cheating?
I do think that's a big part of the story. You know, I have lots of cases in my book about professionals, people who should be solidly part of the middle class or upper middle class and who are feeling an incredible financial stress in their lives because, you know, it's not just that the high school graduate can't make it anymore. Increasingly, it's the college graduate or even somebody with an advanced degree who finds themselves, you know, not being able to afford starter homes that are $500,000, having to pay high health care premiums, being crunched by child care. I mean, a lot of these white-collar families that should be doing well find that they aren't. And so you put these people into professional situations where there is a temptation to cut corners. You know, like lawyers, for example, can easily overbill clients and inflate their hours.
Right.
Doctors take money from pharmaceutical companies to, you know, in an unethical way. There's a lot of temptations out there to cut corners ethically. And people who are part of this upper middle class or middle class who should be secure often give in to those temptations because there is such a financial crunch in their life.
Yeah, because there's essentially many of the pillars of security of our society are being pulled out from underneath us, and even those little fragile, really not all that useful, but they're still there remnants like Social Security. I mean, it's hard to live on Social Security, but even those now, you've got the cons in government, the conservatives in government saying we're going to do away with that. We're talking with David Callahan. He's the author of The Cheating Culture. A great book, Why More Americans Are Doing Wrong to Get Ahead. David, you state that sleeping watchdogs and lax enforcement of laws have made it easier to flout the rules, leading to an epidemic of tax evasion and white-collar crime. What I've noticed is that you get away with it if you're a Bush, a Cheney, a Ken Lay, but if you're a Martha Stewart, who's an unabashed Democrat, or a little person, as Leona Helmsley put it, sometimes you don't get away with it. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, you know, there over the past 20 years since the beginning of the Reagan presidency, there has been this concerted attack on government. Government portrayed as the problem, not the solution. And you saw under the Reagan administration, for example, an evisceration of the Securities and Exchange Commission, which is supposed to be the top cop on Wall Street. And you look at, you know, why have these corporate scandals been happening, not just the most recent ones, but you know, all the way up through, you know, since the 1980s. And it has a lot to do with the fact that these government watchdogs just don't have the resources to go after these white-collar criminals and to try these cases, which are often quite complex. You know, and at the height of the boom in 2000, the SEC admitted that it was only looking at 10 to 15% of the earnings reports that were coming in from companies. So it didn't really have any clue whether most companies were telling the truth about their earnings because it just didn't have the manpower to do that. Very similar story with the IRS. IRS has been downsized over the past 10 or 15 years, and it can't keep on top of all the tax cheating.
Although they're increasing their number of audits of middle class and working class people now. They've diminished, you know, this is the announcement, what, 3 or 4 months ago, that they're reducing the number of audits of corporations and the very wealthy, and they're increasing the number of audits of people who make under $50,000 a year.
Well, actually, the IRS says that it is now pledging to go after wealthier Americans. But the case has been that as the IRS lost power, you know, lost a third of its enforcement capacity during the 1990s, and as the Republican Congress put in more roadblocks in front of it to, you know, actually collect taxes with a new 1998 law, the IRS started going after the little guy, the low-hanging fruit. That was easy. Those cases were easier to prosecute.
Yeah. When it comes to smaller problems like greed, envy, and inequality, you know, the classic issues of ethics, really. Conservative Republicans and laissez-faire ideology has kept the focus away from questions of ethics in everyday life. Talk about this a little bit.
Over the past quarter century, there's been a lot of talk about values in this country, but that talk has almost been entirely dominated by the religious right and conservative moralists like William Bennett. And this dialogue on values has focused almost exclusively on problems like drugs and sexuality, homosexuality, prayer in schools, abortion, crime as traditionally defined. And meanwhile, there has been almost no discussion in the past two decades about what I would call the moral downsides of capitalism, which is, you know, greed, envy, extreme competition. You know, these are the things that instead the conservatives tell us are positive values. And so what I call for in my book is a more balanced values conversation in this country. So it's not just about, you know, these personal issues like abortion, but it's also about very important social issues.
Yeah, I think, you know, George Soros pointed out in his book, Crisis of Global Capitalism, that we really need a new language because when people make statements like you just said that, you know, these are some of the downsides of capitalism, a lot of people go, well, wait a minute, you know, that's our system. It's a good system. I want to start a business. I'd like to be an entrepreneur. I'd like to make some money, blah, blah, blah. And really what you're talking about are the downsides of what's called laissez-faire or unrestrained or unregulated capitalism, whereas in the United States, we've had this pretty clear consensus since 1773 when they threw the tea in Boston Harbor to put their thumb in the nose and in the face of the East India Company, that the corporate behavior should you know, it's fine to have corporations, but they have to operate within limits that are practical and appropriate.
Right, and there needs to be fair rules, and this is something that I come back to again and again in my book, which is that the rules in American society have been tilted heavily toward the rich, and there's a real decline of fairness, and there's been an undermining of the social contract. You know, people need to believe, everybody needs to believe that the rules are fair and that everybody who breaks the rules will be treated the same way and that we all get a say in how the rules are made.
David, I got to ask you to hold that thought. We've got to take a break here, but we'll pick up on the other side of the break if you can stick around with us. We're talking with David Callen, the author of The Cheating Culture, Why More Americans Are Doing Wrong to Get Ahead. It's the Tom Hartman Program, 20 minutes past the hour.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is a small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Waitsfield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates block out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics, check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
At last, there's a positive focus on a condition that affects millions. Read The Edison Gene, ADHD and the Gift of the Hunter Child by Tom Hartman, best-selling author of Attention Deficit Disorder, A Different Perception. John Rady, author of User's Guide to the Brain, says this about the Edison Gene.
Once again, with tireless scholarship and a bit of poetry, Tom Hartman helps take us to the edge of knowing ourselves, our brains, and our world.
The Edison Gene, available in bookstores everywhere.
Hey, what does this word make you think of? Chekhov's
Edison Gene, available in bookstores everywhere.
Hey, what does this word make you think of? Tchaikovsky.
Isn't it? So what's the word?
No, that is the word.
He loves it.
All right, who's Martha Graham?
She invented the graham cracker. Before her, there was only soda crackers.
Maybe they're not getting enough art. Kids who participate in the arts do better in school and in life. To learn more, visit AmericansForTheArts.org. Because all kids should get to appreciate Tchaikovsky's music and Martha Graham's dance. Art. Ask for more. A public service message brought to you by Americans for the Arts and the Ad Council.
Setting up a radio station? Wondering what software to use? Listen to the words of Mike Chandler of WOBS in Florida talking about the Tune Tracker system.
I love the software. I mean, it is
$95 for the pro version with traffic interface and only $149.95 for the original Tune Tracker 2. Either way, you'll have a radio automation system that performs like systems costing thousands more. For more information, go to our website, www.tunetrackersystems.com. www.tunetrackersystems.com.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 24 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Talking with David Callahan, co-founder and director of research at the Public Policy Center Demos and the author of The Cheating Culture, Why More Americans Are Doing Wrong to Get Ahead. 1-866-889-8894 is our telephone number if you'd like to be on the line. If you have a question for David, and in fact, Dave in Humboldt County, California is on the line. Hey, Dave, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Dave, a reality that you may be alluding to, but I can speak to very directly with firsthand knowledge, big corrupt corporations that desire to rip off their customers and get away with it, they dump megabucks into the Republican Party. Some of them back it up with contributions to the Democratic Party. And fact, in reality, the Federal Trade Commission, virtually every agency, tax-supported agency that's there to protect the citizens, now turn their back and will do nothing. They have been bought. The whole party has sold them down the river. I give you several examples of it. I don't know if you can hear that.
Not necessary, Dave. I think we know. We all get it. David, what are your thoughts on Dave's point? Good point, Dave. Thank you.
On which part of it?
Well, and you know, and the idea that the regulatory agencies and well, Dave, correct me if I'm wrong. My take on what you were saying was that the our regulatory agencies are being bought and sold by corporations and with the revolving doors and whatnot. I mean,
well, there's no question that the entire system, regulatory system in Washington, has been corrupted by corporate money. The example of the accounting industry and their influence in Washington is a good one. You know, one of the reasons we had all these corporate scandals was because there wasn't strong enough oversight of the accounting industry. And well, it turned out the accounting industry spent, you know, $100 million during the 1990s on campaign donations and on lobbying.
What a surprise!
To block the rules proposed by the SEC to tighten up oversight of the accounting industry. And, you know, that kind of political muscle was deployed ultimately at the cost of investors who lost out big time when all these corporate scandals occurred because the accountants were not doing their job.
So it sounds to me like the bottom line of what you're saying here is that there has been a sea change in our culture that change has been driven by conservative ideology, shifting us away from what you could argue began largely with Franklin Roosevelt, with the idea that, hey, we're all in this together, we're working together, let's you know, recognize the rights of labor, increasingly, you know, the rights of more and more people, women, blacks, whatnot, got brought into the, you know, let's make the group bigger. And then something changed in the 1980s.
Well, and a number of things changed. If rising economic inequality, one big factor here during the starting in the late 1970s, accelerating in the 1980s, and that made the people at the top get rewards that are so much bigger than ever before, and have more wealth to deploy in the political system to kind of strengthen their sense of prerogative and their privilege, and it also creates new incentives for people to cut corners and cheat and to break the rules to get to the top. You know, if you look at what a lot of these executives were getting paid in stock options during the 90s boom, it really gave them a big incentive to cheat in order to get that, you know, make hundreds of millions of dollars in some cases in just a few years. And we've done nothing to try to oppose that inequality that has grown
now,
so rapidly in American society.
Yeah, now in Sweden, for example, the average CEO makes 15 times what the average worker makes. And it's not mandated by law, because there are four or five multinational corporations headquartered in Sweden where their CEOs make 100, 150 times what the average employee makes. But you take them out, you take that just, you know, handful of companies out of the pot, and the average CEO makes 15 times what the average worker does. This is a cultural pressure, not a legal pressure. How do we come back to that kind of a world? How do we bring ourselves back? We got about a half a minute here, David, to wrap this up.
Well, I think that the progressives and reformers need to be out there talking about a new social contract. You know, we need to create a society where anybody who plays by the rules can get ahead and have a decent life. And I think that means making it easier to earn a good living, raising the minimum wage, getting national health care insurance. And we also need to ensure that whoever breaks the rules gets the same punishment. And I think that means strengthening the government watchdogs, going after the cheaters at the top, and also letting up on this war against the poor that we've been waging, this draconian war against the poor waging for the past 20 years.
And repeal Taft-Hartley and allow the labor to have relatively equal power with management.
That's another important piece of the picture.
Great. David Callahan, the author of The Cheating Culture, Why More Americans Are Doing Wrong to Get Ahead. David, thank you for being with us today.
Great to be here.
Okay, I appreciate it. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Stay tuned. We'll be back.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. The White House wants yet another round of corporate tax cuts. It believes cutting the tax burden on business stimulates job growth. But historical analysis of U.S. federal tax rates and unemployment recently completed by the Brookings Institution shows no basis for the correlation. Look no further than the Reagan era. He cut taxes in 1981, and in the following 2 years, unemployment went up. Over the decade, taxation slowly rose again, and by 1989, the unemployment rate had fallen.
Pop and not so pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
This is WINS, the Workers Independent News Service. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
It'll soon be easier to follow the flow of U.S. jobs overseas due to the latest initiative by the Washington Alliance of Technology Workers and the Communication Workers of America. The groups are launching a website called Offshore Tracker that will include the total number of jobs sent offshore by date and details about companies exporting the jobs. CWA and WashTech expect they'll only be counting about 20% of jobs lost because many companies force their employees to sign non-disclosure agreements. The website is www.techsunite.org/offshore.
In what's believed to be the largest public settlement ever for a case involving HIV-related discrimination, a former performer with Cirque du Soleil will receive $600,000 from the avant-garde acrobatic troupe. Matthew Cusick was fired from the troupe's resident show in Las Vegas last July after his HIV-positive status was revealed, even though company physicians cleared him for performance. Claims that Cusick was a safety hazard provided the justification. But following an investigation by the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, which concluded Cirque du Soleil had discriminated by firing Cusick, the company agreed to the settlement yesterday.
After a year-long strike against meat processing giant Tyson Foods, the membership of the United Food and Commercial Workers Wisconsin Local 538 elected a new president. Of the 329 striking union workers who have asked to come back to work at the Jefferson, Wisconsin plant, 120 are still waiting to return. The new president will have to deal with this, ongoing contract talks with Oscar Mayer, and negotiations with Jones Dairy expected to begin this summer.
Only essential and emergency health services are available in British Columbia this week as 43,000 hospital and clinic workers with Canada's Hospital Employees Union strike to stop a government campaign to privatize the province's health care. Since the government opened up the sector to contracting out 2 years ago, one out of every eight health care workers in the province have either been laid off or seen their wages dramatically reduced. The walkout began on Sunday, but yesterday the BC government took the steps toward ordering the strike to be stopped, which could result in the issuance of a back to work order by as early as tomorrow.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. According to the Labor Research Association, President Bush, unlike the 8.4 million unemployed workers in the United States, has more money than he can spend. Bush has raised so much money that he's suspended all further fundraising for his 2004 presidential campaign. Bush now has the largest campaign fund of any candidate in U.S. history, $180 million. His Democratic challenger, John Kerry's war chest, is $100 million short of that amount.
You've been listening to WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 20 minutes past the hour. And the bumper music just done croaked, so you get to imagine something playing there in the background. Only a third, some interesting stuff out of USA Today here, this new study, this new poll. Only a third of the Iraqi people now believe that the American-led occupation of their country is doing more harm, is doing more good than harm. You get that? Only a third of the Iraqi people now think that we're doing more good than harm. In other words, two-thirds think we're doing more harm than good. And a solid majority, this is of Iraqis, this is not of Ralph Nader voters, this is of Iraqis. This is a study done by the Gallup Organization in conjunction with USA Today and CNN. Good, solid study done. It was done before the siege of Fallujah, which has probably made even more Iraqis hostile toward us. A solid majority of Iraqis support an immediate military pullout, even though they fear that as a result they could be in greater danger. Even though they themselves see or think, you know, hey, I might be in trouble if we just pull out. It's the right thing to do. The Americans should leave, and they should leave right now. As USA Today reports, this is an article by Cesar Soriano and Stephen Camero in USA Today today, a poll, Iraqis out of patience. The poll shows that most Iraqis continue to say the hardships suffered to depose Saddam Hussein were worth it. Well, of course, those hardships were worth it. They were borne largely by our soldiers. Half say they and their families are better off than they were under Saddam. So half say they weren't. A strong majority say they are more free to speak and worship. That's pretty much a no-brainer. But while they acknowledge benefits from dumping Saddam a year ago, and it was basically a year ago this weekend, it was a year ago, day after tomorrow, Saturday, that George Bush walked isn't quite the right word, on the carrier there, and said, you know, under the banner Mission Accomplished, that the White House said that the soldiers had put up. They tried to blame it on the soldiers, and then almost 3 months later admitted that the White House itself had put up the banner, had designed the banner in Washington, D.C., bought the banner out there, ordered the soldiers to put the, or the sailors rather, to put the banner up, and owned the banner. But in any case, a year ago tomorrow. But they acknowledged the benefits from dumping Saddam a year ago. While they acknowledge it, Iraqis no longer see the presence of the American-led military as a plus. Asked whether they view the coalition as liberators or occupiers, 71% of all respondents say occupiers. Occupiers. Isn't that remarkable? 53% say they would feel less secure without the U.S.-led coalition, but 57% say the foreign troops should leave anyway. I guess they agree with Don Rumsfeld. You know, sometimes things get a little crazy, but that's just life. I mean, that's how it is. And, for example, Salam Ahmed, 30, a Shiite businessman, says, "I am not ungrateful that they took away Saddam Hussein, but the job is done. Thank you very much. See you later. Bye-bye." Some people are feeling a little more upset than he is. The article goes on to point out that the insurgents seem to be gaining broad acceptance, if not outright support, for strikes against Americans. This is one of the basic rules that we demonstrated during the American Revolution. And I'm very reluctant to draw any kind of parallels between the American Revolution and what's going on in Iraq, because they're very different situations. But with regard to the engagements, types of warfare, as it were, the British were very upset about the fact that our soldiers did not march in file, and that they would shoot from behind trees, and that we would use churches. You remember Paul Revere's ride? We were using church towers to signal. You know, they were supposed to be neutral, the British said. And we said, hey, we're not going to go along with that. We're going to use whatever we have. And what you find, and what of course our soldiers discovered in Vietnam as well, what the French discovered in Algeria, what the British discovered in Iraq in the 1920s, what over and over and over again occupying forces have discovered over and over and over again all over the world, is that when a certain threshold of the population supports the radicals within that population, and different people suggest that that threshold exists at different points, but when a certain threshold of the population supports the radicals within the population, then those radicals have the ability to melt back into the population and become invisible. And at that point, it is almost impossible to win a war against them. In the case of the American Revolution, it was about a third. About a third of the people living in North America openly supported rebellion against England in 1776, against the United Kingdom. About a third. And that was enough to provide the hidey holes and the hideouts and the homes where people could, you know, hang out. And that was enough to provide that maybe 5% or whatever. You know, I don't know the number. I'm not sure anybody's ever quantified it. But you could just go back and look at the numbers of people in the Continental Army in 1777, 1778, and divide it into the population. But it was a very small percentage of the people who actually went out with a gun and fought against the British. But because they had the support of about a third of the people, they were able to conduct a guerrilla war that ultimately succeeded against the British. And so I've seen some studies that suggest that if as little as 15% of the population supports an insurgency, that the vast majority of the rest of the population, they just want to get on with life. They're interested in, hey, you know, getting to school, getting home, you know, whatever. It's, you know, this, that, and the other thing. I mean, they're They're really not about being political. They're not about, you know, going out and fighting. And so while they don't actively participate in helping the insurgencies, they don't prevent it. They don't stop it. It's sort of like the vast number of people in the United States who don't vote. They didn't prevent George Bush, but they, you know, from getting into office, you know, assuming that he, you know, the vote had something to do with it. Setting aside the realities of the Supreme Court and Jeb and Catherine down in Florida fixing the election before it even happened by knocking 90,000 African Americans off the voting rolls. But, you know, nonetheless, just for sake of argument, you could say that there are millions of people in America, maybe, you know, 50, 60, 70 million Americans, who by not participating allow stuff to happen. Allow these radicals, for example, these extremists, to have taken control of our government. And similarly, you know, if there's just a small threshold, just a small number supporting them, and this, it seems to me, is the turning point that we are up against. And it's a very, very dangerous situation. It's a very unfortunate. I am so concerned about our young men and women who are over there facing this kind of a situation, because it is not, history tells us, it is not a situation you can win. Name one country where there was a popular uprising that was supported by half the population and the invading forces ultimately won, and then that led to democracy. I mean, I can give you a lot of examples where popular uprisings were supported by more than half of the people, and nonetheless, the country was pacified. The Soviet Union did this to Czechoslovakia. The Nazis did it to France. But democracy wasn't the result. And if we're doing anything more than giving lip service to the idea that we're in favor of democracy in Iraq, it appears that we may be traveling down the wrong road, and now would be a good time to have a national dialogue about this. And I'm very much saying this in the context of, we really ought to talk about this, not trying to kick George Bush around, as much as I enjoy doing that. That's not my point. The USA Today article goes on to point out, the Bush administration has contended that the growing armed resistance, which has killed more than 100 Americans this month, you know, we've had more Americans die in the month of April, which is not yet over, than died in the initial, quote, major combat operation that led up to May 1st, when the president got on the USS Abraham Lincoln and said, everything's well, mission accomplished. More of our soldiers have died in this month of April than died taking Iraq in hostile action. So anyhow, they killed more than 100 Americans this month. The Bush administration contends it's the work of isolated cells of former members of Saddam's regime or religious fanatics, often from outside Iraq. Problem is, have you seen any reports of any people from outside Iraq who've been captured? Well, I guarantee you, if we were to capture, you know, Al-Qaeda members from Saudi Arabia or Yemen or, in particular, Syria, we'd be trotting them out in front of the cameras. And we just keep getting Iraqis. Iraqis, the USA Today article continues, Iraqis interviewed in Baghdad this week about the poll results say they have lost patience with the U.S. effort to crush the insurgency and rebuild Iraq. Abbas Kadum Muya, 24, he owns a bicycle shop in Sadr City, which is this very low-income part of Baghdad. Some would call it a slum in Baghdad. Fairly large area, named after Sadr, you know, El Sadr, the clerics, named after his father. He said, I would shoot at the Americans right now if I had a chance. He said, at the beginning there were no problems, but gradually they started to show disrespect and encroach on our rights, arresting people. Now, when the guy who owns the bicycle shop is talking like that, you know you've got a real problem. Sabah Yeldo, a Christian who owns a liquor store across town, says American failures have left the capital with higher crime, less reliable services, including electricity. And he said that is, quote, making everybody look back and seriously consider having Saddam back instead of the Americans, end quote. So he gets back to the point that most people are really not political.
Most people just want their lives to work. They just want their society to work. They're not, rather than saying they're not political, let's say they're not ideological. They're not, you know, they don't have some utopian vision. They don't, I know the right way and it's the only way. You know, that's not, no. Across Baghdad, in the multi-ethnic Baghdad area, so this is like, you know, right across the board, includes Shiites, Sunnis, Christians, Kurds, the whole bunch, very metropolitan city. Across Baghdad, only 13% of people, only 13% of the Iraqis now say that the invasion of Iraq was morally justifiable. Whereas a year ago, more than twice that number said that the invasion was the right thing to do. And here are just some quick stats. This is from the USA Today article here today. Two-thirds of Iraqis say soldiers in the U.S.-led coalition made no attempt to keep ordinary Iraqis from being killed or wounded. In other words, they don't think that we're protecting them. Nearly 58% said the soldiers conduct themselves badly or very badly. Nearly 60% say the troops show disrespect for Iraqi people in searches of their homes. 46% say the soldiers show a lack of respect for Iraqi women. Overall, only 11% of Iraqis say coalition forces are trying hard to restore basic services such as electricity and clean drinking water. They point out in this article that, I'll quote from it, Marines patrolling around Fallujah this week say they can feel the Iraqi anger every day, even when the two sides aren't shooting at each other. Marine Lance Corporal Wes Monks, 23, of Springfield, Oregon, says as he drives around the restive, mostly Sunni town, he sees Iraqis with a knowing, sarcastic smile. He says, you see it every day. We're always the last ones to find out when we run over a mine. It's a tough mission these guys have got. 1-866-889-8894 if you'd like to weigh in on this. The freedoms they gave us are satellite television, satellite telephones, and mobile telephones, says Resha Namir, 20. And you can drive a car without a license, he says, but I can't even go out because I'm afraid at any minute I'll die. The war was not worth it. It was without any reason except to control the oil. We don't want your help, end quote. Michael in Santa Fe has called 1-866-889-8894. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Hey, Tom.
You're live and on the air.
Okay, yes, sir. You know, I was interested in what you're talking about the first hour about the difference how liberals and conservatives view the world, and how human nature. I think liberals look, you know, the glass half full, conservatives half empty. And I look upon the American Revolution and how that ties into Iraq is that I think the American Revolution was America's really first civil war, because many of the people in the South didn't want, you know, to govern themselves, and there's a lot of pro-Tory militias down south that were conservative in nature and opposed the American Revolution.
Not just down south. I actually write about this in a book I've got coming out in July.
Yeah, there were other areas.
I mean, this tore families. this literally tore families apart. The American Revolution.
Right,
I mean,
right.
Much more. This now, is what Jimmy Carter's book is about, by the way.
Right.
Go ahead. And
in Iraq, you see the. I mean, it's interesting to see that the Iraqis want to govern themselves, but the Americans don't want to let them really. Do that.
Yeah, I mean, Sadr has, you know, conducted elections back in June of last year for many municipal posts. And then when we went in and said, well, your elected guy isn't official, so we're going to put in our appointed guy. And in some cases, they took the appointed guy out into the street and threatened to kill him if the elected guy didn't get to take over. And we gave in one of the cities. I think it was Nazaria. I forget which one it was.
Right, So just one more point. Over 200 years, you know, now we're the British.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's crazy.
It is.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Michael, for calling. I appreciate it. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 10 minutes before the hour.
Are you frustrated by your constant inability to lose weight? Are you looking for a natural, clinically proven weight loss breakthrough? Introducing CarboBlocker. Unlike anything else on the market, CarboBlocker is backed by clinical research that proves it effectively helps block the fattening effects of carbs without stimulants. Your body will think you're eating a low-carb diet even when you're not. The results are simply amazing. If you want to maintain the weight loss effects of low-carb dieting for the long run, if you're tired of clothes that are too tight and you want to look fit and sexy, then CarboBlocker is for you. It's clinically effective for
formula is safe, natural, and stimulant-free. And as a special introductory offer, when you order two bottles of Carbo Blocker, you'll get two bottles of Appetite Blocker absolutely free. Call in the next 10 minutes, and you'll also receive two free books, Lose Fat Now and the Low Carb Cookbook, a $100 value. Absolutely free, so call now, 1-800-743-5704. Guaranteed to work or your money back, so call now, 1-800-743-5704. That's 1-800-743-5704.
The Founding Fathers thought they'd stop corporations from ever overthrowing elected government. Little did they know that 200 years later, democracy would be stolen and twisted in the name of so-called conservative values. Hi, this is Tom Hartman. The founders of America fought the Revolutionary War against the excessive corporate power of the East India Company, and presidents from Jefferson to Eisenhower warned us that extremely big businesses could destroy democracy. You'll find this extraordinary American story in my book, Unequal Protection, The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. It starts with the Boston Tea Party and ends with the rampant corruption of the Bush administration. It tells the dramatic story of how corporations hijacked the Bill of Rights, setting the stage for the CEO takeover of America. And it shows how we can take America back and tells the stories of Americans from Pennsylvania to California who are doing just that right now.
Unequal Protection is available in bookstores nationwide. And you can read several chapters online at unequalprotection.com. That's Unequal Protection by Tom Hartman.
Are you or a loved one making too many trips to the bathroom? Listen closely because you're not alone. Over 30 million men suffer from an enlarged prostate. That's why if you make frequent trips to the bathroom, have urgency, hesitancy, or a diminished sex drive, then Super Prostate Formula is for you. It was designed by nationally recognized physician Dr. Michael Toplitzky. The results with his patients have been amazing. Reclaim control now and join the thousands of satisfied customers who have had incredible results with Super Prostate Formula. When you order two bottles of Dr. Toplitzky's Super Prostate Formula, you'll also get two bottles of his Super Libido Formula, an all-natural alternative to Viagra to enhance sexual vitality and performance, plus his book, Complete Guide to Prostate Health, and his newsletter, a total $100 value free as your gift. Guaranteed, or your money back. If you're not completely satisfied, return it for a full refund and keep his Libido Formula book and newsletter free as your gift. Not available in stores? Call now, 800-452-0978. 800-452-0978. That's 800-452-0978.
Renewable energy is at a competitive disadvantage, according to its supporters. They want a level playing field with fossil fuels. I'm Steve Pomplin for Earthwatch Radio. Widespread use of wind power, solar energy, and other renewable resources would address many of our most pressing problems, including pollution, global warming, and dependence on foreign sources of oil. But Alan Nogi of the Union of Concerned Scientists says renewables hardly stand a chance under current energy policy.
Our long-term energy policy has been to support and subsidize the development of fossil fuels and nuclear energy. With barely a few crumbs for developing new clean renewable resources or for really trying to ensure that we have a long-term clean and sustainable energy supply.
Critics say renewable energy technologies are insufficiently developed to meet our energy needs, and they argue that electricity produced from the sun and wind is too expensive. They say the market determines when these resources will play a larger role in our economy. But Nogi says that argument leaves out the competitive advantage given to fossil fuels and nuclear power.
There is no free market in energy. We have a whole huge range of subsidies, from research and development to tax credits and write-offs, limiting the liability of nuclear plant operators and paying for the waste disposal. So we need to have policies that level the playing field to allow these new technologies to get a start and achieve the economies of scale by which they could compete with conventional resources.
Nogi argues for a complete revision of national energy policy. He says the federal government should cut fossil fuel subsidies and give renewable resources a fighting chance. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Gaylord Nelson Institute and the Sea Grant Program at the University of Wisconsin.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
You say good, I say you should.
come back. And will we be there for the Iraqis? Or, for that matter, do they want us there? And now, and, you know, Americans, here, the brand new poll is in the New York Times today. The support for war is down sharply poll concludes. This is a New York Times CBS poll. 46% of Americans thought the United States military should remain in Iraq for as long as it takes to create a stable democracy, even if it takes a long time. On the other hand, 46% said the United States should withdraw as soon as possible. Interesting as the dynamics change. 1-866-889-8894. Jeff in Denver's on the line. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Hey, looking at this, you know, situation in Iraq with the soldiers reacting, I mean, everybody reacting and looking at this, your guest earlier where he's talking about people cheating and so forth, I see that the major problem is that everybody's always reacting based on what somebody else did. They're always basing their lives in the past. And we've, somebody, you know, to break the cycle, somebody has to stand up and start leading and being active, not reactive.
Yeah, well, you know, clearly that's a position, for example, that Ralph Nader is trying to take with regard to this Iraq situation. I'm increasingly of the opinion John Kerry should. I'm amazed that he had the experience he did in Vietnam and he doesn't see the parallels.
Yeah. And, you know, we've just got to start, you know, instead of going, well, this person did that so I can do this.
Yeah.
You know, we've got to really start living, you know, with our own morals. And then, like, dealing with the corporate executives and the cheating, I found it was interesting in the late 80s watching with, like, was it Ivan Besky and people like that?
Yeah, Ivan Bosky, yeah.
Bosky. And you see these great, huge amounts of money these guys would make, and then you'd see their fines were minuscule compared to...
Yeah, and Michael Milken, I mean, you know, he got out of jail. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was when Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act, and you know, Jimmy Carter back in 77, I think, was the last time that the act was actually invoked in breaking up AT&T. And Reagan came in and he said, okay, we're not going to do that anymore. And so all of these corporations started merging with each other, creating these behemoths, which became more politically powerful, became less competitive. And so we, the consumers, ended up getting the short end of the stick. The employees got the short end of the stick. And people like Michael Milken and Ivan Bosky and a whole bunch of them who never got indicted got incredibly wealthy and gave more and more money to the Republican Party. So, yeah, that's where you're at.
We accept limits in all sorts of parts of life. Why not, like speed limits, why not limits in corporations on the ratios of low pay to high pay?
Yeah, it's an entirely reasonable thing. And there are limits on corporations. It's just, you know, it's where do you draw them? How do you draw them? How do you do it? And these are the questions that really we should be discussing in our culture. Jeff, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, helping you win the water cooler wars with uncommon sense from the radical middle.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
They are delicious. Connoisseurs love them. They're imported from France. They're certified eco-friendly, and they're reasonably priced. What am I talking about? Eco Wines. One of the best-kept secrets in America, Eco Wines from the south of France. Brought to you since 1980 by my company, the Organic Wine Company. My name is Véronique. I select these earth-friendly wines personally. They are made with organic grapes. They burst with life and flavor. Our number? Easy to remember. 1-888-ECO-WINE. Our site? Easy to find. EcoWine.com. See, if you're going to eat, eat organic. If you're going to drink, drink wisely. Drink organic. Our future depends on it. Remember our number? 1-888-ECO-WINE. And that is ECOWINE.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
News break from the Minuteman News Service.
This is Don Waller in New York. 9 U.S. soldiers were killed in attacks around Baghdad Thursday, 8 of them when a car bomb exploded just south of the capital. The car bomb went off just south of Baghdad near Mahmoudia around 11:30 a.m. local time, the U.S. military said in a statement. Initial reports indicate that 8 U.S. soldiers were killed and 4 were wounded. The soldiers were all from the 1st Armored Division, and the wounded were flown to Baghdad Military Hospital by helicopter. In a separate incident, a U.S. soldier was killed in a rocket-propelled grenade attack in eastern Baghdad, bringing April's death toll to 125. George W. Bush's approval rating is at an all-time low, and fewer than half of Americans now believe invading Iraq was the right thing to do, according to a CBS New York Times poll released on Wednesday. The poll found that if the presidential election due in November was held today, 46% of Americans would vote for Democrat John Kerry, and 44% would vote for Bush if independent Ralph Nader stayed out of the race. Just 32%, the lowest number ever, say Iraq was a threat that required immediate military action 1 year ago, the poll reported. Most Iraqis believe the ouster of Saddam Hussein was worth the hardships they have endured since the U.S.-led invasion, but Iraqis are sharply divided over whether the country is better off, according to a CNN USA Today Gallup poll released Wednesday. 42% of Iraqis say they believe their country is better off since the invasion launched more than a year ago, while 46% said the war has done more harm than good. Among the findings, the poll said that Iraqi attitudes towards foreign troops have hardened considerably. When asked how they now view coalition forces, 71% of all Iraqis said mostly as occupiers, while 19% said mostly as liberators, the poll said. More Minuteman News after this.
Hi, I'm Jim, and this is my calendar. And I'm setting aside Monday for something special.
And I'm Tina. I'll see your Monday and raise you a Tuesday afternoon.
Oh, yeah? Well, I'm Miguel, and I'm giving up a whole week.
When a lot of people give even a little time to the Red Cross, it adds up to quite a lot. A blood drive, a first aid class, a disaster relief team. When we come together, we become part of something bigger than us all. To find out how you can volunteer, visit redcross.org. The American Red Cross. Together we can save a life.
They say twins feel each other's pain, but 8-year-olds Cassidy and Marissa Weiss of Laurel, Nebraska may have taken that idea a bit too far. In a 5-hour span on April 17th, both girls had rolling skating accidents that resulted in broken left arms. Cassidy broke her arm while skating at a friend's birthday party. Later that evening, Marissa was demonstrating her skating skill to her mother, Tammy, when she fell and broke her arm. The twins were outfitted in matching blue casts. Cassidy was to wear her cast for about 3 weeks. Because Marissa's break was more severe, she was to wear hers for 6. For the Minuteman News Service, this is Don Waller in New York.
Minuteman News Break is a production of TakeBackTheMedia.com.
Murder is not anything I could ever commit, but there are a few individuals whose obituaries I could read without feeling terribly sad. I must admit, however, that one thing does induce murderous thoughts in my otherwise gentle head. Car alarms. Like a demon screeching from the deepest reaches of hell, these satanic devices whoop, beep, razz, whine, and irritate in the most intrusive way, shattering the civility of entire neighborhoods and jangling even the calmest of souls. They seem programmed specifically to go off in the wee hours of morning, rudely awakening families for blocks around in an act of urban harassment. Car alarms are sold in the name of theft protection, but that's a joke. An independent survey of 73 million insurance claims for robbery of vehicles reveals that cars with alarms, quote, show no overall reduction in theft losses. Why? Two reasons. First, nearly all of the whooping is due to false alarms caused by a passing motorcycle, a thump by a cat, or simply because the damn thing decides on its own to interrupt our peace and tranquility. They go off so often that most of us always assume it's a false alarm. An insurance company found that fewer than 1% of people would call the cops because of a blaring car alarm. Second, it's rare to hear an alarm when the car is actually being stolen because real thieves can easily deactivate the devices in only seconds. As one expert puts it, car alarms work about as well as fuzzy dice at deterring theft. Far from stopping crime, they often cause it, as irate neighbors go out in their jammies to puncture tires, sledgehammer hoods, and even shoot the offending vehicles. Plus, all of this is unnecessary, since there are engine immobilizers that can prevent nearly all auto thievery. This is Jim Hightower saying, to help kill screeching car alarms, call Transportation Alternatives, 212-629-8080.
only one army, believes it can win a war. Playing children's games. Please support Salvation Army summer camps and youth programs. To donate, call 1-800-SALARMY or donate online at 1-800-SALARMY.org. We can't win the war without you.
It's a wild day here at the stock market. Let's talk to some traders. How you doing?
I'm taking a shelling, but I'm still gelling.
Okay, and how about you?
I'm gelling and selling. Gelling and selling.
My trades are smelling.
Mine too, but who cares?
We're gelling.
Are you gelling yet? Dr. Scholl's massaging gel insoles are made from the softest gel ever created. If you and your feet don't feel outrageously comfortable, you get your money back, guaranteed. Are you gelling? Dr. Scholl's.
Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 7 minutes past the hour. Glad to be back. It's the third hour of the Thursday afternoon, April 29 program, day 285 in the search for the traitor in the White House who outed Valerie Plame. They're still looking. Day 339 in the search for weapons of mass destruction. 924 days since the anthrax killers struck, leading to the passage of the Patriot Act. And 954 days since Osama bin Laden was declared wanted, dead or alive. Speaking of which, let's have a contest. Let's give away a book. We the People, A Call to Take Back America, is my newest book. It is an illustrated book. It is, let's see, how many pages is it? It's over 200 pages. I don't want to call it a comic book. It's illustrated. And it actually has, in my opinion, some of the most solid, detailed, factual, historical information of any of the books that I've written. We the People Are Called to Take Back America, and we will give away a copy to the first person who calls with the correct answer to this question. First of all, the number to call when you hear the answers and you know which one is right is 1-866-889-8894. Here's the question, and then I'll give you four answers. This is multiple choice, and you get to choose A, B, C, or D. The question is, what did George W. Bush say when asked by a reporter whether the war on terrorism had changed him? Did he say, A, I believe it has. I believe it's made me a bit more bloodthirsty. Or did he say, B, it's pretty much allowed me to do whatever I want in the name of Homeland Security. Or did he say, C, talk to my wife. I don't know. I don't spend a lot of time looking in the mirror except when I comb my hair. Or did he say, D, I'll tell you this, I sure got to say evildoers a lot more than I would have otherwise. Which is it? Which of those four things did George W. Bush say when asked by a reporter whether the war on terrorism had changed him? Did he say, A, I believe it has. I believe it's made me a bit more bloodthirsty. Did he say, B, it's pretty much allowed me to do whatever I want in the name of Homeland Security? Did he say, C, talk to my wife? I don't know. I don't spend a lot of time looking in the mirror except when I comb my hair. Or did he say, D, I'll tell you this, I sure got to say evildoers a lot more than I would have otherwise. Your choice, 1-866-889-8894. I see our lines are lighting up. Call in if you think you know the answer, and you will win a copy of We the People, A Call to Take Back America. A question I'd like to get into in this hour is, should John Kerry change his position on the war in Iraq? And I'd like to hear your thoughts on this as well. It's, feel free. 866-889-8894, our number, of course. And if you get a busy signal, just, keep trying. But here we have the situation, this New York Times CBS poll, and I'm not saying that John Kerry should change his position on the war because of a poll. What I am suggesting is that the poll indicates that there is a change happening. We just saw that we talked in the last hour about the poll that was conducted in Iraq. And in this hour, the poll that was conducted in the United States. Okay, so which, you know, and this poll is indicating that there is a change actually in attitude in the United States as well. Now, that doesn't mean that a politician should, you know, lick his finger and stick it up and say, which way does the wind blow? Ah, we have a winner, by the way. You can stop calling. It's we have a winner to our contest. And, you know, I just, rats, I lost the page that the thing was on. So I can't, so much for that. Pamela, welcome to the Tom Hartman program. What was the answer?
The answer is his wifey question.
See, I don't ask my wife. I don't spend much time looking in the mirror except when I comb my hair.
Yeah, and that's probably a big one, you know.
Yeah, right. This is the anti-introspection president. It's just absolutely
totally.
Yeah, anti-introspection. Okay, Pamela, you've already sounded good, Tom. Yeah, thank you. You've already given your name and address and all that stuff. So we
no,
can send you.
Just my name.
You haven't? Okay, well, hang on, Pamela. I'm going to put you on hold and we'll get that information.
Thank you. I listen to you every day.
Great. Well, thanks for calling. I appreciate it. Hang on, Pamela. Okay. So George Bush says, "I don't know. Talk to my wife. He doesn't spend much time looking at himself." Interesting. So anyhow, what should John Kerry do about this war? We have a situation now where America is evenly divided, 46% to 46%, basically 50-50, about whether we should, as George Bush would say, stay the course with strong, steady, and determined leadership, using all those buzzwords that they've so carefully vetted with their focus groups, or whether we should, as George Bush would say, cut and run, you know, coming up with the words that would scare people. And, you know, which is it? What should we be doing? What should we be doing? What should John Kerry be doing? You know, he's kind of left himself an opening. He's left himself an opportunity there to change his position. He's kind of, I don't want to say he's been all over the map on this thing, but I want to say he's, well, it's a tough one. I mean, the situation has been changing and evolving. I think that early on in Vietnam, there were probably some people who thought that it was the right thing. Clearly, John Kerry did when he enlisted and volunteered to go over there. And then they, you know, reality hit them in the face. They said, you know, but wait a minute. You know, this isn't what we thought it was. So what should he do? I think, personally, that he should start talking about, you know, it's time for us to get out as quickly as we can. And let's get elections happening quickly. And of course, if things go, and to a large extent, George Bush has borrowed John Kerry's suggestion. I mean, Kerry back, you know, 6 months ago was saying, bring in the United Nations, put into place a temporary government that is nothing but Iraqis and is not made up of phony Iraqis. It's not made up of people from out of town who came in and camped out, like Ahmed Chalabi, the great bank robber. And, you know, bring in a government of Iraqis and then very quickly have that government set up and supervise elections and have the elections overseen by the United Nations and make sure that they're fair elections and let the chips fall where they may. And, you know, I think there's something to that. Part of the problem is the Constitution. The Constitution that has been ratified by the Governing Council, this hand-picked Governing Council, a lot of folks say, well, the Saad and Sistani, for that matter, you know, representing a good chunk of the 60% majority of the Shia population of Iraq, is saying this isn't a legitimate Constitution. We don't think that it's right and fair that conservative economic values be imposed on our nation. We don't want multinational corporations coming in and buying up our companies and exporting our jobs to China. We don't want that. We don't want multinational corporations coming in, buying up our companies, taking the natural resources of our country out of our country, and leaving behind a few paltry-paying jobs. We don't want that. We would rather have a system that we can control and we can decide what we're going to export, what we're going to import, where we're going to have tariffs and barriers and whatnot to protect our domestic industries. We don't like George Bush's vision of how a nation should be run. Doesn't seem to be working in America, and we don't think it'll work here. Now, ironically, the Iraqi Constitution does call for every Iraqi citizen to have free health care through a national single-payer system. Another thing I think John Kerry should be calling for. And I believe that, you know, Ralph Nader's in favor. You know, Kerry should just steal Nader's platform. I mean, you know, as I've said many times, I am going to vote for John Kerry because I am absolutely terrified of the possibility of more damage being done to my nation, to our democracy, to our freedoms, to our infrastructure. Because I am absolutely terrified of the possibility of more damage being done to my nation, to our democracy, to our freedoms, to our infrastructure. More ripping off of America by the wealthy patrons of the Bush administration. It's intolerable. It is, you know, we are seeing the destruction of the middle class. We're seeing for the first time since the Environmental Protection Agency went into business during the Nixon administration back in, as I recall, 1973. We're seeing for the first time now air and water actually reversing and getting worse in quality rather than better. As the cons are running around quoting last year, that makes contributions to the political parties, of course. And so, you know, it's just very strange. Anyhow, 55% of Mr. Bush's supporters, this according to this new New York Times CBS poll, 55% of Bush's supporters said they strongly favored the president. Only 32% of Kerry supporters say they strongly favor Kerry. I'm not sure what strongly favor means. But, you know, if you asked me, I would say, well, you know, I'm not altogether in favor of everything he stands for, but I'm in favor of most of what he stands for. And I'll certainly vote for him. Does that mean I strongly favor him? Yeah, I'd rather have Howard Dean, I suppose, or Dennis Kucinich. But, you know, if John Kerry can win, I am right there. So I'm not, you know, a lot of these things have to do with how it's... 61% of voters said Mr. Kerry says what he thinks people want to hear versus 29% who said he says what he believes. This is the consequence of George Bush spending $50 million on advertising to convince Americans that John Kerry is a flip-flopper. Just absolutely remarkable. 46 and 46 believe we should get out of Iraq. If the election were held today, 46% of registered voters would vote for Mr. Kerry, 44% for Mr. Bush. That sounds like good news, isn't it? However, with Mr. Nader in the race, Mr. Bush would get 43%, Mr. Kerry 41%, and Mr. Nader 5%, suggesting that nearly all of Mr. Nader's support comes from voters who would otherwise back John Kerry. Will Ralph Nader throw the election to John Kerry? Your thoughts, 1-866-889-8894. It's Tom Hartman, 20 minutes past the hour.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is a small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates block out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
How can contemporary America possibly compare with 1933 Germany? Find out in Tom Hartman's brand new fully illustrated book, We the People, A Call to Take Back America. Through Tom's concise political analysis and Neil Cohn's vibrant illustrations, you'll observe an unsettling, if not shocking, perspective of America. You'll also hear what the founders of this country did to control corporate power. You'll be invited to consider how the American political system can be made more democratic, as well as comprehend the project for the new American century's vision for America. Here's what syndicated cartoonist Ted Rawl said after reading We the People.
An ambitious effort to explain everything that's wrong in America, how things got this way, and what should be done about it. We the People is the product of a brilliant and principled thinker.
We the People, a call to take back America by Tom Hartman, available in bookstores everywhere. A must-read, The Edison Gene, ADHD and the Gift of the Hunter Child by Tom Hartman, best-selling author of Attention Deficit Disorder, A Different Perception. Ed Halliwell, a nationally recognized expert on ADD, said this about The Edison Gene.
Tom Hartman demonstrates that ADHD can be associated with creativity, high achievement, and a most successful adaptive style.
The Edison Gene, now available in bookstores everywhere.
The war they are in has been declared over by the same man who lied them into it. Their reward? Combat pay cut in half. $1.5 billion cut to their family housing. $20 billion cut to military health care. No health care for reservists.
Comanchers, bring them on.
Thousands wounded, hundreds dead, and no end in sight. If we support our troops, why can't Bush? Or is this what they mean when they say, an army of one?
Hey, how you doing? Got a quick question.
Yeah?
Who was Rudolf Nureyev?
Rudy Nureyev.
Rudy.
Okay, I know this one.
Good.
Wasn't he wasn't he a defenseman for the Maple Leafs?
Sure about that?
Could have been a goalie.
Yeah. Hey, hi. How you doing? Who was Louis Armstrong?
That's easy. He was the first guy on the moon.
Really?
You know, one small step for man.
Sure, one giant leap for Louis. Hey, young lady.
Uh-huh.
Does the name Carlo Baggio mean anything to you?
Wasn't he the guy that went out with that mob guy's sister until he got whacked?
You know, no.
Are your kids as well-rounded as they could be? Kids who participate in the arts do better in school and in life. To learn more about the value of arts education, visit AmericansForTheArts.org. Because all kids should get to appreciate Nureyev's dance, Armstrong's horn, and Caravaggio's brush. Art. Ask for more. A public service message brought to you by Americans for the Arts.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. One of the folks in our chat room corrects me. Ralph Nader apparently is not in favor of a single-payer health system, but rather a national health service program. There's a significant difference. In England, they have a national health service program. It's basically what you would call socialized medicine. It's where the government owns the healthcare system. It owns the hospitals. The doctors are employees of the government. The government owns the pharmacies. The government owns the whole thing. And whereas a single-payer system, which I'm quite sure is what Dennis Kucinich is supporting, and what I support aggressively, a single-payer system is where the government pays the bills. But you still have doctors can be entrepreneurs, they can work for themselves. You can, you know, hospitals, in my opinion, should be nonprofit corporations only. Local, you know, it's part of the commons. They should be local community things as they were in the United States basically up until the last 15, 20 years when, you know, predators like Bill Frist were able to make out like bandits on this thing. Anyhow, let's go to the phones here. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Bob in Groton, Massachusetts is on the line. Hey, Bob, is it Groton or Groton?
It's Groton.
Groton, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly think Kerry ought to adopt a more Kucinich-like stand on Iraq. I mean, I happen to be part of a group of Kucinich volunteers who are now preparing for the Democratic National Convention. You know, we're in the Boston area.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, trying to influence the platform because we think Kerry could do better on a lot of things.
Yeah, he certainly seems to be kind of, you know, going down the middle of the road in a way that, You know, what's the old, was it James Carville wrote the book? No, it was Jim Hightower. The only thing in the middle of the road is dead armadillos and yellow stripes.
Right. I mean, I think someone cautioned him that it was risky to put too much distance on the war issue because Bush can manipulate that so easily.
Yeah, which is true. I mean, Bush would, if he was to say, well, let's pull out, then Bush would start yelling, he's in a cut and running, he's a coward, he's, you know, Hanoi John, you know, blah de blah de blah, and probably would polarize the nation against him on that one issue, and then would start charging that he isn't a patriot, that every man who dies or every man or woman who dies in Iraq died because the Iraqi insurgents were given new energy and enthusiasm by virtue of the fact that Kerry opposed the war. You know, all those things that they trotted out during Vietnam, they would trot out again. And
well,
odds are there's no way he could win.
It seems to mean that a war can't be an issue, can't be a campaign issue.
Right, and if that were to happen, there's probably no way he could win. You know, it's if that were to happen. So maybe it's, you know, really bad advice to give him to say, hey, you know, get more Nader-like about the war because it would mean his instant destruction.
On the other hand, I know a lot of people that would make very enthusiastic about him.
Yeah, I know. It's a terrible irony, isn't it?
Yeah.
Thanks a lot for the call, Bob. Great to hear from you. I appreciate it. 1-866-889-8894, a telephone number, 27 minutes past the hour. And John in Santa Fe is on the line. Hey, John, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I have a question for you, which you may or may not be able to answer. But the issue before the Supreme Court, the Cheney Energy Task Force?
Yes.
And I guess they're going to make a decision in July, but there's a very good chance they'll rule in the executive branch Cheney's favor in that.
Yeah, it seems that way based on the questioning. It seems that Scalia was getting quite aggressive in the questioning and basically signaling everybody that he's going to be the swing vote and he's going to make it happen.
My question is, if they do rule in the favor of the vice president and then Kerry is elected, will Kerry be able to release those, what happened in those meetings, or will that forever be kept from the American public?
No, Kerry would be able to release them. The question is the discretion of the office, not the confidentiality of the documents.
So those won't go to Bush's private library and hold up forever?
I may be wrong, but I don't think so. I really don't think so. And in fact, you know, the vice president technically is a very separate position from the president. The vice president shouldn't have, traditionally hasn't had executive privilege. He's claiming executive privilege because he's saying he was acting on the orders of the president, that he was an agent of the president, not because he was the vice president. Because the vice president really just has two jobs, to be the president of the Senate, to break ties in the Senate, and to periodically inquire about the health of the president. I mean, that's all the Constitution says. So I think that this would... Well, it's hard to say. You know, I'm not a legal scholar here, John. I don't know. But I think that Kerry would be able to release this. I would certainly hope so.
Yeah, well, John. One more reason he should be elected.
There you go. There you go. Yeah, one more of a million. Thanks, John, for the call. I appreciate it. 29 minutes past the hour at the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 866-889-8894.
Think you're not involved in your community? Think again. Spending your money with local businesses is more than an economic choice. It's a way you can have a say in the look and feel of your hometown. By creating a demand for local goods and services, we can ensure a place for the independent businesses that help give our communities character and keep them unique. The American Independent Business Alliance encourages you to get involved. Support your homegrown businesses. Find Amoeba online at amiba.net.
Pop and not so pop culture, democracy and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
This is WINS, the Workers Independent News Service. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
It'll soon be easier to follow the flow of U.S. jobs overseas due to the latest initiative by the Washington Alliance of Technology Workers and the Communication Workers of America. The groups are launching a website called Offshore Tracker that will include the total number of jobs sent offshore by date and details about companies exporting the jobs. CWA and WashTech expect they'll only be counting about 20% of jobs lost because many companies force their employees to sign non-disclosure agreements. The website is www.techsunite.org/offshore.
In what's believed to be the largest public settlement ever for a case involving HIV-related discrimination, a former performer with Cirque du Soleil will receive $600,000 from the avant-garde acrobatic troupe. Matthew Cusick was fired from the troupe's resident show in Las Vegas last July after his HIV-positive status was revealed, even though company physicians cleared him for performance. Claims that Cusick was a safety hazard provided the justification. But following an investigation by the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, which concluded Cirque du Soleil had discriminated by firing Cusick, the company agreed to the settlement yesterday.
After a year-long strike against meat processing giant Tyson Foods, the membership of the United Food and Commercial Workers Wisconsin Local 538 elected a new president. Of the 329 striking union workers who have asked to come back to work at the Jefferson, Wisconsin plant, 120 are still waiting to return. The new president will have to deal with this, ongoing contract talks with Oscar Mayer, and negotiations with Jones Dairy expected to begin this summer.
Only essential and emergency health services are available in British Columbia this week as 43,000 hospital and clinic workers with Canada's Hospital Employees Union strike to stop a government campaign to privatize the province's health care. Since the government opened up the sector to contracting out 2 years ago, one out of every eight health care workers in the province have either been laid off or seen their wages dramatically reduced. The walkout began on Sunday, but yesterday the BC government took the steps toward ordering the strike to be stopped, which could result in the issuance of a back to work order by as early as tomorrow.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. According to the Labor Research Association, President Bush, unlike the 8.4 million unemployed workers in the United States, has more money than he can spend. Bush has raised so much money that he's suspended all further fundraising for his 2004 presidential campaign. Bush now has the largest campaign fund of any candidate in U.S. history, $180 million. His Democratic challenger, John Kerry's war chest, is $100 million short of that amount.
You've been listening to WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 27 minutes before the hour. It is unfortunate, said Justice Anthony Kennedy yesterday at the Supreme Court, that our legislators have reached the point of declaring that when it comes to apportionment, we are in the business of rigging elections. What's that all about? We'll get to that in just a minute. 1-866-889-8894 if you'd like to weigh in on the issues of the day. Tim in Santa Fe is on the line. Hey, Tim, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. What a great show, as usual.
Thank you.
One of the things that actually, right before the break, one of the other callers and you were talking about what was going on in Iraq. And as I remember, the reason we went over there was to find weapons of mass destruction and to get Saddam Hussein. And the way I look at it is we've done both.
Right.
And it's time for us to leave.
Yeah, and the people of Iraq apparently think the same thing.
Yeah.
Or at least a majority. Not just a plurality, but a majority of them.
I think by saying that, you know, let's bring it back to why we were there to begin with, or you know, the lie that we told to get over there, and let's get out.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks, Tim, for the call. It's good to hear from you. Larry Diamond went to Baghdad in January. The San Francisco Chronicle did a really nice story on this by James Sterngold, a Chronicle staff writer, about Larry Diamond, who he's an authority on building democracy. And in January, he went to Baghdad as an advisor to the coalition authorities, the U.S. occupation authority. And he went in, you know, all full of enthusiasm, and, you know, he was going to help them. You know, he's the coordinator of the democracy program at Stanford's Center for Democracy Development and the Rule of Law. And since 1990, he has been the co-editor of a publication called the Journal of Democracy. This is a guy who's an expert on democracy, how it happens, how it works, what happens. And he goes over to Iraq thinking, oh boy, we're going to make a democracy happen there. This is going to be so cool. And he's also now a senior fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution, which is one of these kind of international think tanks, international issue think tanks. He says, we have just bungled this so badly. We just weren't honest with ourselves or with the American people about what was going to be needed to secure the country. Now, keep in mind, this is coming from one of the senior advisors to the Coalition Provisional Authority. One of Paul Bremer's top people. He says, and I quote, it was mind-blowing, really. There were people who wanted to know how to make democracy work. There were so many positive signs. Civil society was very weak, as you'd expect, but it was beginning to reconstitute itself. There was a lot of energy, a lot of passion, a lot of creativity, a lot of desire to learn. I even had a good experience with some mullahs who supported us. But then what happened? But Diamond said this from the San Francisco Chronicle article, but Diamond said it was around the time that the insurgency grew bolder, that more Americans and Iraqis began to die, and the security appeared to be collapsing. He said he shuddered as he began to see other advisors, keep in mind he was an advisor, getting killed on the same roads he traveled. He called it a transforming experience, a painful experience. And then he says, I had one of those moments where you cut through all the bull. He said, I was speaking to this woman's group, and one woman got up and said, if we do all these things, who's going to protect us? All these things being the stuff necessary to bring about democracy. And Diamond says, that was the moment when I said to myself, oh my God, some of these women are going to be assassinated because they are here listening to me. It just struck me between the eyes. The Chronicle notes, as the violence spread, Diamond said, he felt ever more painfully the mistake the United States had made by not sending in more troops to keep the insurgents at bay. He said, in his view, the United States must double its current military force and offer political benefits to those who lay down their arms and accept democratic institutions. You know, it's the carrot and stick. You can't have just one or just the other. He says, with greater security, there would have been a constitution, more flexible and responsive government. None of that is likely to happen now. He says, this guy is now saying, we have blown it. The Rumsfeld Doctrine, we blew it. He says, the literature stresses the overwhelming need to get security under control. Nothing that happened could not have been anticipated. In other words, we could easily have expected all of this stuff. And in fact, the generals did anticipate all this stuff, and George Bush fired two of them. Anyhow, Diamond says, nothing that happened could not have been anticipated. I don't think we were applying the lessons of the past as systematically as they should have been, to put it as politely as possible. So, yeah, it's time for us to be reconsidering Iraq. And, you know, as kind of thinking this thing out loud, if John Kerry does it, it could be absolute political suicide, because then all the cons are going to come out saying he's a traitor, he is aiding the enemy while our soldiers are in battle. And there actually may even be some truth to that. You know, the insurgents may get some added enthusiasm, and it may make it even more difficult, and more of our soldiers may die, and perhaps Kerry's unwilling to allow that to happen. It's a tough one. What I absolutely do know, is that having been in Vietnam, having served in Vietnam, and having been active in the anti-war movement, John Kerry understands this situation better than George Bush does and will work out the most appropriate solution if and when he is elected, regardless of what he says before the election. I just know that. I mean, it's common sense. So, now, what's this about Anthony Kennedy, one of the Supreme Court justices, saying it's unfortunate that our legislators have reached the point of declaring that when it comes to apportionment, we are in the business of rigging elections. Apportionment, of course, is how voting districts are divided up. Who represents what district? This was a ruling that was laid down yesterday by the Supreme Court. It didn't get a lot of play in the press. I think this is a big deal. This is part of the Republican plan to create one-party rule in the United States. It's part of the Stalinist approach to governance that this Republican Party is promoting and has been ever since it was hijacked by the radical ultra-conservatives. The Associated Press notes, this is an article by David Espo, a divided Supreme Court on Wednesday, yesterday, upheld a Republican-drawn redistricting plan for Pennsylvania. Now, most people don't even know about what happened in Pennsylvania. It's very similar to what happened in Texas. The Constitution says that every 10 years, there shall be a national census. And the Constitution elsewhere says that, I believe it's in the 14th Amendment, actually, the latest update of it, says that the number of members of the House of Representatives from a particular state is a function of the population of that state. So what happens is those states that gain population during the 10 years between the two censuses actually get more legislators. They get more. They have the same number of senators. Every state has two senators, but they get more members of the House of Representatives, which is right now, I believe, at 435. And those states that lose population get fewer. And, you know, and ultimately it kind of all balances out. And what has been happening is that in those states where the Republicans control the House and Senate of the state, at the local level, they have been going in and redrawing the lines of the districts so that Democratic members of the House of the United States House of Representatives are now being thrown into largely Republican districts, and the largely Democratic voting areas are getting, you know, sliced into little ribbons and getting diluted. So you can actually end up with a state where the majority of the people would vote Democratic, and yet the state will send majority Republicans to the House of Representatives because of the way that they've created these districts. It goes back to Congressman Jerry of, as I recall, New Jersey. Somebody sent me an email correcting me on that one time, and I don't remember if they corrected me that it was New Jersey or if my, maybe it was Delaware. Anyhow, I think it was New Jersey. Congressman Jerry back, you know, this was back late 19th century, early 20th century, and he created a district, or helped create a district, that looked like a salamander. And, you know, the newspapers made a big deal about it, and they called it gerrymandering. And that's what happened in Texas, and this was a process that was driven by Tom DeLay. Now, the Constitution implies that a state should only be redistricting after the census, every 10 years. In other words, every year that ends with a zero. 2000, 2010, 2020, 2030. But the Republicans went in and said, okay, we did this in 2000. We didn't like the result. We've got power now. We didn't have power then. And so we're going to do it again. And we're going to shove it down the throats of the Democrats, whether they like it or not. And the Democrats fled the state twice, maybe three times it was, to prevent the vote that would have institutionalized this, because the Republicans had the majority to make the vote happen. So rather than, you know, losing the vote, they just didn't want to allow it to bring it up for a vote. And ultimately, they kind of caved in on this, said, okay, we'll take it to the Supreme Court. A similar situation happened in Pennsylvania. The Democratic legislators didn't leave the state to try and stop it. Instead, they sued. They took it to the Supreme Court, and they said, hey, you know, we can understand redrawing districts once every 10 years. That's how it's been done for 220 years in the United States. But we don't get this thing about whenever you get into power in a state, you take that opportunity to redraw the districts, even though it has nothing to do with the census. It's not right. It's not been done before. It's just a pure, naked political power grab. And by a 5-4 ruling, and guess who broke the tie? Mr. Duck Hunter. By a 5-4 ruling, the court ruled That the Republicans in Texas, Pennsylvania, and anywhere else they want can gerrymander districts anytime they want. Scalia wrote the court's main ruling. And although this was a Pennsylvania case, the question on everybody's mind was, will this ruling apply to Texas and any other state where the Republicans decide to pull off this kind of stunt? And Scalia said essentially yes. He said he would, quote, decline to adjudicate these political gerrymandering claims from other states, end quote. In other words, this is our position and don't bring us any more of these cases. Now, Justice John Paul Stevens was outraged. Speaking from his seat on the bench, he said the courts would not sit by when state leaders of one political party take over boundary drawing in an invidious, undemocratic, and unconstitutional practice. He went on to say the Constitution does not require the fox to guard the henhouse. But his opinion was in the minority. Thanks to Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush making their appointments to the Supreme Court. Scalia, Thomas. So now we have, and now, you know what the irony of this is? The absolute and utter irony of this. The Republicans are doing this absolute power grab, and I really think that they have this notion that they can create this single-party state and they will be all-powerful and every knee will bow and every tongue confess that the Republicans are in charge and that's going to be it forever. And they don't realize nothing lasts forever. And the American people at some point, well, maybe they think it will. Maybe they think they can control the voting machines or whatever. But it ain't going to happen. I'm telling you, it doesn't happen. Things go in cycles. The pendulum goes back and forth in this country and all other democracies. It's just the way it is. And there's a lot of Republicans out there who should be scratching their heads right now saying, wait a minute, are these the rules that we would want to live under if the Democrats were in charge? If the Democrats were the ones whose corporations controlled the voting machines, if the Democrats were the ones who were gerrymandering districts every year in order to enhance their political power in the House of Representatives, would we want to live under those rules? And of course, the answer is no. But they're behaving like adolescents with short attention spans. Yeah, maybe. Louise says they know the Democrats are nicer. Yeah, you know, frankly, I think you're right. I think they are betting on the fact that they can play hardball, they can play dirty pool, they can play the game against the rules, and when the Democrats get into power, the Democrats have such a commitment to democracy and the rule of law that they won't abuse power the way the cons have. I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right. And actually, you go back and you look, and history shows that. I mean, Clinton, there were so many things Clinton could have done, so many ways he could have exploited his presidential power. And it wasn't like they never occurred to him. I mean, Ronald Reagan did many of them. George Herbert Walker Bush did many of them. He saw it happening under the so-called Gingrich Revolution. Yeah, Reagan, Clinton did bring us NAFTA and GATT, but he didn't do it as a power grab. He did it with good old-fashioned lobbying. He spent a week on the telephone, you know, begging, pleading, cutting deals. But it wasn't the kind of threatening stuff that we're seeing out of these guys now. The future of our country. Get active, get registered, get out there, vote. 10 minutes before the hour.
Are you frustrated by your constant inability to lose weight? Are you looking for a natural, clinically proven weight loss breakthrough? Introducing CarboBlocker. Unlike anything else on the market, CarboBlocker is backed by clinical research that proves it effectively helps block the fattening effects of carbs without stimulants. Your body will think you're eating a low-carb diet even when you're not. The results are simply amazing. If you want to maintain the weight loss effects of low-carb dieting for the long run, if you're tired of clothes that are too tight and you want to look fit and sexy, then CarboBlocker is for you. It's clinically effective formula is safe, natural, and stimulant-free. And as a special introductory offer, when you order two bottles of Carbo Blocker, you'll get two bottles of Appetite Blocker absolutely free. Call in the next 10 minutes, and you'll also receive two free books, Lose Fat Now and the Low Carb Cookbook, a $100 value. Absolutely free, so call now, 1-800-743-5704. Guaranteed to work or your money back, so call now, 1-800-743-5704. That's 1-800-743-5704.
The last hours of ancient sunlight, the fate of the world, and what we can do before it's too late is Tom Hartman's stunning wake-up call to humanity. Conversations with God author Neil Donald Walsh says this about the book.
Quote it everywhere. Buy 10 books and give them away. Don't let this action go unheard. You may feel like a voice in the wilderness, but it is your voice we're waiting to hear. Yours is the crucial vote. You are the determining factor. We reach critical mass when we reach you, and you choose to reach others with the simple message of this book. Let us act at last in the best interest of all. Then the sun will shine another day, and another still, and life will not merely go on, but achieve its highest expression, its grandest glory, its greatest joy. Can we give this gift to our children? Please say yes.
The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, The Fate of the World and What We Can Do Before It's Too Late by Tom Hartman. Available in bookstores everywhere.
Are you or a loved one making too many trips to the bathroom? Listen closely because you're not alone. Over 30 million men suffer from an enlarged prostate. That's why if you make frequent trips to the bathroom, have urgency, hesitancy, or a diminished sex drive, then Super Prostate Formula is for you. It was designed by nationally recognized physician Dr. Michael Toplitzky. The results with his patients have been amazing. Reclaim control now and join the thousands of satisfied customers who have had incredible results with Super Prostate Formula. When you order two bottles of Dr. Toplitzky's Super Prostate Formula, you'll also get two bottles of his Super Libido Formula, an all-natural alternative to Viagra to enhance sexual vitality and performance, plus his book, Complete Guide to Prostate Health, and his newsletter, a total $100 value free as your gift. Guaranteed, or your money back. If you're not completely satisfied, return it for a full refund and keep his Libido Formula book and newsletter free as your gift. Not available in stores. Call now, 800-452-0978. 800-452-0978. That's 800-452-0978.
Growing popularity of bottled water is creating trash and polluting the air. I'm Steve Pomplin for Earthwatch Radio. Some people drink bottled water because they think it's healthier than tap water. But bottled water is a significant source of pollution, according to journalist Brian Howard. He says buying single-use plastic bottles has significant environmental impacts.
Well, in the U.S., 9 out of 10 plastic water bottles end up as either garbage or litter. That translates to 30 million per day. Globally, to make these bottles, we're talking about 1.5 million tons of plastic. Now, in the U.S., for the domestic supply, that translates to 1.5 million barrels of oil just to make those bottles. Just to put that in perspective, that's enough oil to fuel 100,000 cars for 1 year.
Howard is the managing editor of E! Magazine. He says transporting tons of bottled water over very long distances creates air pollution.
It's much less efficient to put water into bottles and put it on trucks, especially diesel trucks. Diesel fumes are very high in particulate matter, and certainly you're using a lot of greenhouse gases.
Howard says people concerned with the quality of their tap water should consider buying a filter. He says good filters are cheaper and more sustainable than bottled water, but filters collect and concentrate hazardous materials, so he recommends people recycle them rather than throw them in the garbage. He says some manufacturers will take back used filters and dispose of them properly. Howard says another option is to buy bottled water in bulk and pour it into reusable containers, and he urges consumers to buy from local suppliers instead of products that have been shipped from far away. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Gaylord Nelson Institute and the Sea Grant Program at the University of Wisconsin.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
She came, she found an angel. Goo 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 goo.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you in our chat room. It's Greenwood 1963 says, is there anything useful or valid in the conservative philosophies of Russell Kirk and Ayn Rand varieties? Well, first of all, the Russell Kirk conservative philosophy and the Ayn Rand objectivist philosophy have a lot of differences. They're very different. But I'd say the Russell Kirk, Edmund Burke historic conservative philosophy, no, in my opinion, there's very little to commend it. Perhaps the idea that change should happen slowly in societies, which is why these guys who are in power right now are not conservatives, they're radicals. But in any case, that may have some value. But by and large, no, because it's based on flawed assumptions. It's based on the assumption that human nature is essentially evil and that power has to be power must be asserted in order to accomplish even good ends. And history doesn't show that to be true. And any thinking person knows it's not true. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. And Armin in Florida is going to have our last thought for the day. Hey, Armin, what's on your mind?
I'm just trying to figure out that the so-called Republican Party that's in, the Family Values Party.
Yeah. You mean the Family Values Party that doesn't value families?
Really. And ethics either.
Yeah.
Because we had a Democratic president, and it appears, as far as Republicans in Congress are concerned, it's more important to swear in a president, if he's a Democrat, to ask him about questions about stains on a dress than it is a president that's a Republican that lies and takes troops to an illegal war.
Well, and beyond that, I mean, the ultimate family value is, can you support your family? Do you have a livable wage? Do you have health care? Can you retire? Do you have a pension? Can your kids go to a decent school? These are family values, and these are the things that the Republican Party has not only ignored, but has rolled back the clock on 100 years, back to the 1880s. I mean, they've just absolutely, starting in the 1980 with Reagan, they have just been rolling back the clock on these things. And then they point to little niche issues like abortion and say, oh, we're in favor of family values. And yet families are going down the tubes all over America. We got bankruptcy rates higher than they've ever been.
Right. They need to add one word to their little proclaimed agenda, and they ought to call themselves the Party of Corporate Family Values.
There you go. Well said. Armin, thank you very much for that. Always great to hear from you. Thanks, Louise, for producing a great program today. Thank you, Brad Walrod, for engineering our music in New York City. Thanks to Shelby with RadioPower.org and Ben with White Rose Society and Mike Toth, who also does our archives for the TomHartman.com website. Thanks to the folks in our chat room for showing up, and thanks to you for listening. We'll see you tomorrow, same time, same place.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
Did you know that grapes are one of the most heavily sprayed of all agricultural products? Most people don't. But that is why it's so very important to drink wines that are made with certified organic grapes. And that is exactly what we are inviting you to do today. Taste our wines. We select them personally. They come from small properties in the south of France. They are delicious. Connoisseurs love them. And they are earth-friendly. My name is Véronique. I founded the Organic Wine Company in 1980 for people just like you. People who love wine and want to do well by our earth.